Chapter 1. That branch of the Lake of Como, which turns toward the south between two unbroken chains of mountains, presenting to the eye a succession of bays and gulfs, formed by their jutting and retiring ridges, suddenly contracts itself between a headland to the right and an extended sloping bank on the left, and assumes the flow and appearance of a river. The bridge by which the two shores are here united, appears to render the transformation more apparent, and marks the point at which the lake ceases, and the Ada recommences, to resume. However, the name of underscore lake underscore where the again receding banks allow the water to expand itself anew into bays and gulfs. The bank, formed by the deposit of three large mountain streams, descends from the bases of two contiguous mountains, the one called St. Martin, the other by a Lombard name, underscore Risagon underscore, from its long line of summits, which in truth give it the appearance of a saw, so that there is no one who would not at first sight, especially viewing it in front, from the ramparts of Milan that face the north, at once distinguish it in all that extensive range from other mountains of less name and more ordinary form. The bank, for a considerable distance, rises with a gentle and continual ascent, then breaks into hills and hollows, rugged or level land, according to the formation of the mountain rocks, and the action of the floods. Its extreme border, intersected by the mountain torrents, is composed almost entirely of sand and pebbles, the other parts of fields and vineyards, scattered farms, country seats, and villages, with here and there a wood which extends up the mountainside. Lecco, the largest of these villages, and which gives its name to the district, is situated at no great distance from the bridge, upon the margin of the lake, nay, often, at the rising of the waters, is partly embosomed within the lake itself, a large town at the present day, and likely soon to become a city. At the period of our story, this village was also fortified, and consequently had the honor to furnish quarters to a governor, and the advantage of possessing a permanent garrison of Spanish soldiers, who gave lessons in modesty to the wives and daughters of the neighborhood, and toward the close of summer never failed to scatter themselves through the vineyards, in order to thin the grapes, and lighten for the rustics the labors of the vintage. From village to village, from the heights down to the margin of the lake, there are innumerable roads and paths. These vary in their character, at times precipitous, at others level, now sunk and buried between two ivy-clad walls, from whose depth you can behold nothing but the sky, or some lofty mountain peak, then crossing high and level tracks, around the edges of which they sometimes wind, occasionally projecting beyond the face of the mountain, supported by prominent masses resembling bastions, whence the eye wanders over the most varied and delicious landscape. On the one side you behold the blue lake, with its boundaries broken by various promontories and necks of land, and reflecting the inverted images of the objects on its banks; on the other, the Ada, which, flowing beneath the arches of the bridge, expands into a small lake, then contracts again, and holds on its clear serpentining course to the distant horizon. Above, are the ponderous masses of the shapeless rocks; beneath, the richly cultivated acclivity, the fair landscape, the bridge; in front, the opposite shore of the lake, and beyond this, the mountain, which bounds the view. Towards evening, on the 7th day of November, 1628, Don Abbondio, curate of one of the villages before alluded to, but of the name of which, nor of the house and lineage of its curate, we are not informed, was returning slowly towards his home, by one of these pathways. He was repeating quietly his office, in the pauses of which he held his closed breviary in his hand behind his back, and as he went, with his foot he cast listlessly against the wall the stones that happened to impede his path, at the same time giving admittance to the idle thoughts that tempted the spirit, while the lips of the worthy man were mechanically performing their function. Then raising his head and gazing idly around him, he fixed his eyes upon a mountain summit, where the rays of the setting sun, breaking through the openings of an opposite ridge, illumined its projecting masses, which appeared like large and variously shaped spots of purple light. He then opened anew his breviary, and recited another portion at an angle of the lane, after which angle the road continued straight for perhaps 70 paces, and then branched like the letter Y into two narrow paths. The right-hand one ascended towards the mountain, and led to the parsonage, underscore cura underscore, that on the left ascended the valley towards a torrent, and on this side the wall rose out to the height of about 2 feet. The inner walls of the two narrow paths, instead of meeting at the angle, ended in a little chapel, upon which were depicted certain long, sinuous, pointed shapes, which, in the intention of the artist, and to the eyes of the neighboring inhabitants, represented flames, and amidst these flames certain other forms, not to be described, that were meant for souls in purgatory, souls in flames of a brick color, upon a ground of blackish gray, with here and there a bare spot of plaster. The curate, having turned the corner, directed, as was his wont, a look toward the little chapel, and there beheld what he little expected, and would not have desired to see. At the confluence, if we may so call it, of the two narrow lanes, there were two men, one of them sitting astride the low wall, his companion leaning against it, with his arms folded on his breast. The dress, the bearing, and what the curate could distinguish of the countenance of these men, left no doubt as to their profession. They wore upon their heads a green network, which, falling on the left shoulder, ended in a large tassel, from under which appeared upon the forehead an enormous lock of hair. Their mustachios were long, and curled at the extremities, the margin of their doublets confined by a belt of polished leather, from which were suspended, by hooks, two pistols, a little powder horn hung like a locket on the breast. On the right-hand side of the wide and ample breeches was a pocket, out of which projected the handle of a knife, and on the other side they bore a long sword, of which the great hollow hilt was formed of bright plates of brass, combined into a cipher. By these characteristics they were, at a glance, recognized as individuals of the class of bravos. This species, now entirely extinct, flourished greatly at that time in Lombardy. For those who have no knowledge of it, the following are a few authentic records, that may suffice to impart an idea of its principal characteristics, of the vigorous efforts made to extirpate it, and of its obstinate and rank vitality. As early as the 8th of April, 1583, the most illustrious and most excellent Lord Don Charles of Aragon, Prince of Castelvetrano, Duke of Terranova, Marquis of Avila, Count of Burgato, High Admiral and High Constable of Sicily, Governor of Milan, and Captain General of His Catholic Majesty in Italy, fully informed of the intolerable misery which the city of Milan has endured, and still endures, by reason of bravos and vagabonds, publishes his decree against them, declares and designates all those comprehended in this proclamation to be regarded as bravos and vagabonds, who, whether foreigners or natives, have no calling, or, having one, do not follow it, but, either with or without wages, attach themselves to any knight, gentleman, officer, or merchant, to uphold or favor him, or in any manner to molest others. All such he commands, within the space of 6 days, to leave the country, threatens the refractory with the galleys, and grants to all officers of justice the most ample and unlimited powers for the execution of his commands. But, in the following year, on the 12th of April, the said Lord, having perceived that this city still continues to be filled with bravos, who have again resumed their former mode of life, their manners unchanged, and their number undiminished, puts forth another edict still more energetic and remarkable, in which, among other regulations, he directs that any person whatsoever, whether of this city or from abroad, who shall, by the testimony of two witnesses, be shown to be regarded and commonly reputed as a bravo, even though no criminal act shall have been proved against him, may, nevertheless, upon the sole ground of his reputation, be condemned by the said judges to the rack for examination, and although he make no confession of guilt, he shall, notwithstanding, be sentenced to the galleys for the said term of 3 years, solely for that he is regarded as, and called a bravo, as above mentioned, and this because his excellency is resolved to enforce obedience to his commands. One would suppose that at the sound of such denunciations from so powerful a source, all the bravos must have disappeared forever. But testimony, of no less authority, obliges us to believe directly the reverse. This testimony is the most illustrious and most excellent Lord Juan Fernandez de Velasco, Constable of Castile, High Chamberlain of His Majesty, Duke of the City of Frias, Count of Haro and Castel Nuovo, Lord of the House of Velasco, and of that of the Seven Infanti of Lara, Governor of the State of Milan, and C. On the 5th of June, 1593, he also, fully informed how great an injury to the common weal, and how insulting to justice, is the existence of such a class of men, requires them anew to quit the country within 6 days, repeating very nearly the same threats and injunctions as his predecessor. On the 23d of May, then, 1598, having learned, with no little displeasure, that the number of bravos and vagabonds is increasing daily in this state and city, and that nothing is heard of them but wounds, murders, robberies, and every other crime, to the commission of which these bravos are encouraged by the confidence that they will be sustained by their chiefs and abettors, he prescribes again the same remedies, increasing the dose, as is usual in obstinate disorders. Let every one, then, he concludes, carefully beware that he do not, in any wise, contravene this edict, since, in place of experiencing the mercy of his excellency, he shall prove his rigor and his wrath, he being resolved and determined that this shall be a final and peremptory warning. But this again did not suffice, and the illustrious and most excellent lord, the Signor Don Pietro Enriquez de Acevedo, Count of Fuentes, Captain and Governor of the State of Milan, fully informed of the wretched condition of the city and state, in consequence of the great number of bravos that abound therein, and resolved wholly to extirpate them, publishes, on the 5th of December, 1600, a new decree, full of the most rigorous provisions, and with firm purpose that in all rigor, and without hope of remission, they shall be wholly carried into execution. We are obliged, however, to conclude that he did not, in this matter, exhibit the same zeal which he knew how to employ in contriving plots and exciting enemies against his powerful foe, Henry IV, against whom history attests that he succeeded in arming the Duke of Savoy, whom he caused to lose more towns than one, and in engaging in a conspiracy the Duke of Bourbon, whom he caused to lose his head. But as regards the pestilent race of bravos, it is very certain they continued to increase until the 22d day of September, 1612, on which day the most illustrious and most excellent Lord Don Giovanni de Mendoza, Marquese de la Hinojosa, gentleman, and C., governor, and C., thought seriously of their extirpation. He addressed to Pandolfo and Marco Tullio Malatesti, printers of the royal chamber, the customary edict, corrected and enlarged, that they might print it, to accomplish that end. But the bravos still survived, to experience, on the 24th of December, 1618, still more terrific denunciations from the most illustrious and most excellent Lord, Don Gomez Suarez de Figueroa, Duke of Feria, governor, and C., yet, as they did not fall even under these blows, the most illustrious and most excellent Lord Gonzalo Fernandez de Cordova, under whose government we are made acquainted with Don Abondio, found himself obliged to republish the usual proclamation against the bravos, on the 5th day of October, 1627, that is, a year, a month, and 2 days previous to the commencement of our story. Nor was this the last publication, but of those that follow, as of matters not falling within the period of our history, we do not think it proper to make mention. The only one of them to which we shall refer, is that of the 13th day of February, 1632, in which the most illustrious and most excellent Lord, the Duke of Feria, for the second time governor, informs us, that the greatest and most heinous crimes are perpetrated by those styled bravos. This will suffice to prove that, at the time of which we treat, the bravos still existed. It appeared evident to Don Abondio that the two men above mentioned were waiting for someone, and he was alarmed at the conviction that it was for himself, for on his appearance, they exchanged a look, as if to say, "'Tis he." Rising from the wall, they both advanced to meet him. He held his breviary open before him, as though he were employed in reading it, but, nevertheless, cast a glance upward in order to espy their movements. Seeing that they came directly toward him, he was beset by a thousand different thoughts. He considered, in haste, whether between the bravos and himself there were any outlet from the road, and he remembered there was none. He took a rapid survey of his conduct, to discover if he had given offense to any powerful or revengeful man, but in this matter, he was somewhat reassured by the consoling testimony of his conscience. The bravos drew near, and kept their eyes upon him. He raised his hand to his collar, as if adjusting it, and at the same time turned his head round, to see if anyone were coming. He could discover no one. He cast a glance across the low stone wall upon the fields, no one. Another on the road that lay before him, no one, except the bravos. What is to be done? Flight was impossible. Unable to avoid the danger, he hastened to encounter it, and to put an end to the torments of uncertainty. He quickened his pace, recited a stanza in a louder tone, did his utmost to assume a composed and cheerful countenance, and finding himself in front of the two gallants, stopped short. "Señor curate," said one of them, fixing his eyes upon him, "dash. Your pleasure, sir," suddenly raising his eyes from his book, which he continued to hold open before him. "You intend," pursued the other, with the threatening and angry mien of one who has detected an inferior in an attempt to commit some villainy, "you intend tomorrow to unite in marriage Renzo Tramaglino and Lucy Mandela." "That is," said Don Abondio with a faltering voice, "that is to say, you gentlemen, being men of the world, are very well aware how these things are managed. The poor curate neither meddles nor makes, they settle their affairs amongst themselves, and then, they come to us, as if to redeem a pledge, and we are the servants of the public." "Mark now," said the bravo in a low voice, but in a tone of command, "this marriage is not to take place, neither tomorrow, nor at any other time." "But, my good sirs," replied Don Abondio, with the mild and gentle tone of one who would persuade an impatient listener, "but, my good sirs, deign to put yourselves in my situation. If the thing depended on myself, you see plainly, that it does not in the least concern." "Hold there," said the bravo, interrupting him, This matter is not to be settled by prating. We neither know nor care to know any more about it. A man once warned you, understand us. But, fair sirs, you are too just, too reasonable. But, interrupted the other comrade, who had not before spoken, but this marriage is not to be performed, or, with an oath, he who performs it will not reap it of it, because he'll not have time, with another oath. Hush, hush, resumed the first orator, the senior curate knows the world, and we are gentlemen who have no wish to harm him if he conducts himself with judgment. Senior curate, the most illustrious Senior Don Roderick, our patron, offers you his kind regards. As in the height of a midnight storm a vivid flash casts a momentary dazzling glare around and renders every object more fearful, so did this underscore name underscore increase the terror of Don Abbondio, as if by instinct, he bowed his head submissively, and said, if it could but be suggested to me. Oh! Suggested to underscore you underscore, who understand Latin. Exclaimed the bravo, laughing, it is for you to manage the matter. But, above all, be careful not to say a word concerning the hint that has been given you for your good, for if you do, ehem. You understand the consequences would be the same as if you performed the marriage ceremony. But say, what answer are we to carry in your name to the most illustrious Senior Don Roderick? My respects. Speak more clearly, Senior Curate. That I am disposed, ever disposed, to obedience. And as he spoke the words he was not very certain himself whether he gave a promise, or only uttered an ordinary compliment. The bravos took, or underscore appeared underscore to take them, in the more serious sense. "'Tis very well, good night, Senior Curate," said one of them as he retired, together with his companion. Don Abbondio, who a few minutes before would have given one of his eyes to avoid the ruffians, was now desirous to prolong the conversation. "Gentlemen," he began, as he shut his book. Without again noticing him, however, they passed on, singing a loose song, of which we will not transcribe the words. Poor Don Abbondio remained for a moment, as if spellbound, and then with heavy and lagging steps took the path which led towards his home. The reader will better understand the state of his mind, when he shall have learned something more of his disposition, and of the condition of the times in which it was his lot to live. Don Abbondio was not, as the reader may have perceived, endowed with the courage of a lion. But from his earliest years he had been sensible that the most embarrassing situation in those times was that of an animal, furnished with neither tusks nor talons, at the same time having no wish to be devoured. The arm of the law afforded no protection to a man of quiet, inoffensive habits, who had no means of making himself feared. Not that laws and penalties were wanting for the prevention of private violence, the laws were most express, the offenses enumerated, and minutely particularized, the penalties sufficiently extravagant, and if that were not enough, the legislator himself, and, a hundred others to whom was committed the execution of the laws, had power to increase them. The proceedings were studiously contrived to free the judge from everything that might prevent his passing sentence of condemnation. The passages we have cited from proclamations against the bravos, may be taken as a faithful specimen of these decrees. Notwithstanding this, or, it may be, in underscore consequence underscore of this, these proclamations, reiterated and reinforced from time to time, served only to proclaim in pompous language the impotence of those who issued them, or, if they produced any immediate effect, it was underscore that underscore of adding to the vexations which the peaceful and feeble suffered from the disturbers of society. Impunity was organized and affected in so many ways as to render the proclamations powerless. Such was the consequence of the sanctuaries and asylums, and of the privileges of certain classes, partly acknowledged by the legal power, partly tolerated in silence, or feebly opposed, but which, in underscore fact underscore, were sustained and guarded by almost every individual with interested activity and punctilious jealousy. Now this impunity, threatened and assailed, but not destroyed, by these proclamations, would naturally, at every new attack, employ fresh efforts and devices to maintain itself. The proclamations were efficient, it is true, in fettering and embarrassing the honest man, who had neither power in himself nor protection from others, inasmuch as, in order to reach every person, they subjected the movements of each private individual to the arbitrary will of a thousand magistrates and executive officers. But he, who before the commission of his crime had prepared himself a refuge in some convent or palace where bailiffs never dared to enter, or who simply wore a livery, which engaged in his defense the vanity or the interest of a powerful family, such a one was free in his actions, and could laugh to scorn every proclamation. Of those very persons whose part it was to ensure the execution of these decrees, some belonged by birth to the privileged class, others were its clients and dependents, and as the latter as well as the former had, from education, from habit, from imitation, embraced its maxims, they would be very careful not to violate them. Had they, however, been bold as heroes, obedient as monks, and devoted as martyrs, they could never have accomplished the execution of the laws, inferior as they were in number to underscore those underscore with whom they must engage, and with the frequent probability of being abandoned, or even sacrificed, by him who, in a moment of theoretical abstraction, might require them to act. But, in addition to this, their office would be regarded as a base one in public opinion, and their name stamped with reproach. It was therefore very natural that, instead of risking, nay, throwing away, their lives in a fruitless attempt, they should sell their inaction, or, rather, their connivance, to the powerful, or, at least, exercise their authority only on those occasions when it might be done with safety to themselves, that is, in oppressing the peaceable and the defenseless. The man who acts with violence, or who is constantly in fear of violence from others, seeks companions and allies. Hence it happened that, during these times, individuals displayed so strong a tendency to combine themselves into classes, and to advance, as far as each one was able, the power of that to which he belonged. The clergy was vigilant in the defense and extension of its immunities, the nobility, of its privileges, the military, of its exemptions, the merchants and artisans were enrolled in companies and fraternities, the lawyers were united in leagues, and even the physicians formed a corporation. Each of these little oligarchies had its own appropriate power. In each of them the individual found the advantage of employing for himself, in proportion to his influence and dexterity, the united force of numbers. The more honest availed themselves of this advantage merely for their defense, the crafty and the wicked profited by it to assure themselves of success in their rogueries, and impunity from their results. The strength, however, of these various combinations was far from being equal, and, especially in the country, the wealthy and overbearing noblemen, with a band of bravos, and surrounded by peasants accustomed to regard themselves as subjects and soldiers of their lord, exercised an irresistible power, and set all laws at defiance. Don Abbondio, neither noble, rich, nor valiant, had from early youth found himself alone and unaided in such a state of society, like an earthen vessel thrown amidst iron jars. He therefore readily obeyed his parents, who wished him to become a priest. He did, to say the truth, not regard the obligations and the noble ends of the ministry to which he dedicated himself, but was only desirous to secure the means of living, and to connect himself with a powerful and respected class. But no class provided for the individual, or secured his safety, underscore further underscore than to a certain point, none rendered it unnecessary for him to adopt for himself a system of his own. The system of Don Abbondio consisted chiefly in shunning all disputes. He maintained an unarmed neutrality in all the contests that broke out around him, between the clergy and the civil power, between persons in office and nobles and magistrates, bravos and soldiers, down to the squabbles of the peasantry themselves, terminated by the fist or the knife. By keeping aloof from the overbearing, by affecting not to notice their acts of violence, by bowing low and with the most profound respect to all whom he met, the poor man had succeeded in passing over 60 years without encountering any violent storms, not but that he also had some small portion of gall in his composition, and this continual exercise of patience exacerbated it to such a degree, that, if he had not had it in his power occasionally to give it vent, his health must have suffered. But as there were a few persons in the world connected with himself whom he knew to be powerless, he could, from time to time, discharge on them his long pent-up ill humor. He was, moreover, a severe censor of those who did not regulate their conduct by his example, provided he could censure without danger. According to his creed, the poor fellow who had been cudgelled had been a little imprudent, the murdered man had always been turbulent, the man who maintained his right against the powerful, and met with a broken head, must have been somewhat wrong, which is, perhaps, true enough, for in all disputes the line can never be drawn so finely as not to leave a little wrong on both sides. He especially declaimed against those of his confraternity, who, at their own risk, took part with the oppressed against a powerful oppressor. This, he said, was to purchase trouble with ready money, to kick at snarling dogs, and an intermeddling in profane things that lower the dignity of the sacred ministry. He had, in short, a favorite maxim, that an honest man, who looked to himself and minded his own affairs, never met with any rough encounters. From all that has been said, we may imagine the effect the meeting just described must have had upon the mind of poor Don Abbondio. Those fierce countenances, the threats of a lord who was well known not to speak idly, his plan of quiet life and patient endurance disconcerted in an instant, a difficulty before him from which he saw no possibility of extrication, all these thoughts rushed confusedly through his mind. If Renzo could be quietly dismissed with a refusal, all would be well, But he will require reasons, and what can I say to him? He too has a head of his own, a lamb, if not meddled with but once attempt to cross him, oh! And raving after that Lucy, as much enamored as, young idiots. Who, for want of something else to do, fall in love, and must be married, forsooth, thinking of nothing else, never concerning themselves about the trouble they bring upon an honest man like me. Wretch that I am! Why should those two scowling faces plant themselves exactly in my path, and pick a quarrel with me? What have I to do in the matter? Is it I that mean to wive? Why did they not rather go and speak? Ah! Truly, that which is to the purpose always occurs to me after the right time. If I had but thought of suggesting to them to go and bear their message, but here he was disturbed by the reflection, that to repent of not having been the counselor and abettor of evil, was too iniquitous a thing, and he therefore turned the rancor of his thoughts against the individual who had thus robbed him of his tranquility. He did not know Don Roderick, except by sight and by report. His sole intercourse with him had been to touch chin to breast, and the ground with the corner of his hat, the few times he had met him on the road. He had, on more than one occasion, defended the reputation of that senior against those who, in an undertone, with sighs and looks raised to heaven, had execrated some one of his exploits. He had declared 100 times that he was a respectable cavalier. But at this moment he, in his own heart, readily bestowed upon him all those titles to which he would never lend an ear from another. Having, amidst the tumult of these thoughts, reached the entrance of his house, which stood at the end of the little glebe, he unlocked the door, entered, and carefully secured it within. Anxious to find himself in society that he could trust, he called aloud, "Perpetua, Perpetua," advancing towards the little parlor where she was, doubtless, employed in preparing the table for his supper. Perpetua was, as the reader must be aware, the housekeeper of Don Abbondio, an affectionate and faithful domestic, who knew how to obey or command as occasion served, to bear the grumbling and whims of her master at times, and at others to make him bear with hers. These were becoming every day more frequent. She had passed the age of 40 in a single state, the consequences, _she_said, of having refused all the offers that had been made her, her female friends asserted that she had never found anyone willing to take her. "Coming," said Perpetua, as she set in its usual place on the little table the flask of Don Abbondio's favorite wine, and moved slowly toward the parlor door. Before she reached it he entered, with steps so disordered, looks so clouded, and a countenance so changed, that an eye less practiced than that of Perpetua could have discovered at a glance that something unusual had befallen him. "Mercy on me! What is it ails my master?" "Nothing, nothing," said Don Abbondio, as he sank upon his easy chair. "How, nothing? Would you have me believe that, looking as you do? Some dreadful accident has happened." "Oh! For the love of heaven! When I say nothing, it is either nothing, or something I cannot tell." "That you cannot tell, not even to me? Who will take care of your health? Who will give you advice?" "Oh! Peace, peace! Do not make matters worse. Give me a glass of my wine." "And you will still pretend to me that nothing is the matter?" said Perpetua, filling the glass, but retaining it in her hand, as if unwilling to present it except as the reward of confidence. "Give here, give here," said Don Abbondio, taking the glass with an unsteady hand, and hastily swallowing its contents. "Would you oblige me then to go about, asking here and there what it is has happened to my master?" said Perpetua, standing upright before him, with her hands on her sides, and looking him steadfastly in the face, as if to extract the secret from his eyes. "For the love of heaven, do not worry me, do not kill me with your pother, this is a matter that concerns my life."
"Your life?"
"My life. You know well, that, when you have frankly confided in me, I have never—"
"Yes, forsooth, as when?"
Perpetua was sensible she had touched a false string, wherefore, changing suddenly her note, "My dear master," said she, in a moving tone of voice, "I have always had a dutiful regard for you, and if I now wish to know this affair, it is from zeal, and a desire to assist you, to give you advice, to relieve your mind." The truth is, that Don Abbondio's desire to disburden himself of his painful secret was as great as that of Perpetua to obtain a knowledge of it, so that, after having repulsed, more and more feebly, her renewed assaults, after having made her swear many times that she would not breathe a syllable of it, he, with frequent pauses and exclamations, related his miserable adventure. When it was necessary to pronounce the dread name of him from whom the prohibition came, he required from Perpetua another and more solemn oath. Having uttered it, he threw himself back on his seat with a heavy sigh, and, in a tone of command, as well as supplication, exclaimed, "Dash!
for the love of heaven, dash. Mercy upon me, cried Perpetua, what a wretch! What a tyrant! Does he not fear God? Will you be silent? Or do you want to ruin me completely? Oh! We are here alone, no one can hear us. But what will my poor master do? See there now, said Don Abbondio, in a peevish tone, see the fine advice you give me. To ask of me, what I'll do. What I'll do. As if you were the one in difficulty, and it was for me to help you out. Nay, I could give you my own poor opinion, but then. But then, let us know it. My opinion would be, that, as everyone says our Archbishop is a saint, a man of courage, and not to be frightened by an ugly fizz, and who will take pleasure in upholding a curate against one of these tyrants, I should say, and do say, that you had better write him a handsome letter, to inform him as how. Will you be silent? Will you be silent? Is this advice to offer a poor man? When I get a pistol bullet in my side, God preserve me. Will the Archbishop take it out? Ah! Pistol bullets are not given away like sugar plums, and it were woeful if those dogs should bite every time they bark. If a man knows how to show his teeth, and make himself feared, they hold him in respect. We should not have been brought to such a pass, if you had stood upon your rights. Now, all come to us, by your good leave, too. Will you be silent? Certainly, but it is true though, that when the world sees one is always ready, in every encounter, to lower. Will you be silent? Is this a time for such idle talk? Well, you'll think of it tonight, but in the meantime do not be the first to harm yourself, to destroy your own health, eat a mouthful. I'll think of it, murmured Don Abbondio, certainly I'll think of it. I must think of it, and he arose, continuing no. I'll take nothing, I've something else to do. But, that this should have fallen upon me. Swallow at least this other little drop, said Perpetua, as she poured the wine. You know it always restores your stomach. Oh! There wants other medicine than that. So saying, he took the light, and muttering, a pretty business this. To an honest man like me. And tomorrow, what is to be done? With other like exclamations, he went towards his bedchamber. Having reached the door, he stopped a moment, and before he quitted the room, exclaimed, turning towards Perpetua, with his finger on his lips for the love of heaven, be silent. Chapter 2. It is related that the Prince of Condé slept soundly the night preceding the Battle of Rocroi, but then, he was greatly fatigued, and moreover had made every arrangement for the morrow. It was not thus with Don Abbondio, he only knew the morrow would be a day of trouble, and consequently passed the night in anxious anticipation. He could not for a moment think of disregarding the menaces of the bravos, and solemnizing the marriage. To confide to Renzo the occurrence, and consult with him as to the means, God forbid. He remembered the warning of the bravo, not to say one word otherwise, _hem_! And this dreadful _hem_! Of the bravo resounded in the ears of Don Abbondio, so that he already repented of his communication to Perpetua. To fly was impossible, and where _could_ he fly? At the thought, a thousand obstacles presented themselves. After long and painful deliberation, he resolved to endeavor to gain time, by giving Renzo some fanciful reasons for the postponement of the marriage. He recollected that in a few days more the time would arrive, during which marriages were prohibited. And if I can keep this youngster at bay for a few days, I shall then have 2 months before me, and in 2 months who can tell what may happen? He thought of various pretexts for his purpose, and though they were rather flimsy, he persuaded himself that his authority would give them weight, and that his experience would prevail over the mind of an ignorant youth. We will see, said he to himself, he thinks of his love, but I think of myself, I am, therefore, the party most interested, I must call in all my cunning to assist me. I cannot help it, young man, if you suffer, I must not be the victim. Having somewhat composed his mind with this determination, he at length fell asleep. But his dreams, alas! How horrible bravos, Don Roderick, Renzo, roads, rocks, cries, bullets! The arousing from sleep, after a recent misfortune, is a bitter moment. The mind at first habitually recurs to its previous tranquility, but is soon depressed by the thought of the contrast that awaits it. When alive to a sense of his situation, Don Abbondio recapitulated the plans of the night, made a better disposal of them, and after having risen, awaited with dread and impatience the moment of Renzo's arrival. Lorenzo, or as he was called, Renzo, did not make him wait long. At an early hour he presented himself before the curate with the joyful readiness of one who was on this day to espouse her whom he loved.
He had been deprived of his parents in his youth, and now practiced the trade of a weaver of silk, which was, it might be said, hereditary in his family. This trade had once been very lucrative, and although now on the decline, a skillful workman might obtain from it a respectable livelihood. The continual emigration of the tradesmen, attracted to the neighboring states by promises and privileges, left sufficient employment for those who remained behind. Besides, Renzo possessed a small farm, which he had cultivated himself when otherwise unoccupied, so that, for one of his condition, he might be called wealthy, and although the last harvest had been more deficient than the preceding ones, and the evils of famine were beginning to be felt, yet, from the moment he had given his heart to Lucy, he had been so economical as to preserve a sufficiency of all necessaries, and to be in no danger of wanting bread. He appeared before Don Abbondio gaily dressed, and with a joyful countenance. The mysterious and perplexed manner of the curate formed a singular contrast to that of the handsome young man. "What is the matter now?" thought Renzo, but without waiting to answer his own question, "Signor curate," said he, "I am come to know at what hour of the day it will be convenient for you that we should be at the church?"
"Of what day do you speak?"
"How? Of what day? Do you not remember that this is the day appointed?"
"Today?"
replied Don Abbondio, as if he heard it for the first time, "today? Today? Be patient, I cannot today."
"You cannot today? Why not?"
"In the first place, I am not well."
"I am sorry for it, but we shall not detain you long, and you will not be much fatigued."
But then.
"But then, what, sir?"
"There are difficulties."
"Difficulties? How can that be?"
"People should be in our situation, to know how many obstacles there are to these matters. I am too yielding, I think only of removing impediments, of rendering all things easy, and promoting the happiness of others. To do this I neglect my duty, and am covered with reproaches for it. In the name of heaven, keep me not thus in suspense, but tell me at once what is the matter. Do you know how many formalities are required before the marriage can be celebrated?"
"I must, indeed, know something of them," said Renzo, beginning to grow angry, "since you have racked my brains with them abundantly these few days back. But are not all things now ready? Have you not done all there was to do?"
All, you expect, but be patient, I tell you. I have been a blockhead to neglect my duty, that I might not cause pain to others. We poor curates we are, as may be said, ever between a hawk and a buzzard. I pity you, poor young man. I perceive your impatience, but my superiors, enough, I have reasons for what I say, but I cannot tell all we, however, are sure to suffer. But tell me what this other formality is, and I will perform it immediately. Do you know how many obstacles stand in the way?"
"How can I know anything of obstacles?"
"Error, conditio, votum, cognatus, crimen, cultus disparitas, vis, ordo. See Citifinus."
"Oh! For heaven's sake, how should I understand all this Latin?"
"Be patient, dear Renzo, I am ready to do, all that depends on me. I wish to see you satisfied, I wish you well, and when I think that you were so happy, that you wanted nothing when the whim entered your head to be married."
"What words are these, signor?"
interrupted Renzo, with a look of astonishment and anger.
"I say, do be patient, I say, I wish to see you happy. In short, my dear child, I have not been in fault, I did not make the laws.
Before concluding a marriage, we are required to search closely that there be no obstacles. Now, I beseech you, tell me at once what difficulty has occurred?"
"Be patient, these are not points to be cleared up in an instant. Their underscore will underscore be nothing, I hope, but whether or not, we must search into the matter. The passage is clear and explicit, antiquam matrimonium denunciat.
I'll not hear your Latin.
But it is necessary to explain to you.
But why not do this before? Why tell me all was prepared? Why wait?
See there now. To reproach me with my kindness. I have hastened everything to serve you, but there has occurred, well, I know.
And what do you wish that I should do?"
"Be patient for a few days."
"My dear child, a few days are not eternity, be patient."
"For how long a time then?"
"We are coming to a good conclusion," thought Don Abbondio. "Come," said he, gently, "in 15 days I will endeavor."
15 days. Oh! This is something new. To tell me now, on the very day you yourself appointed for my marriage, that I must wait 15 days.
15, resumed he, with a low and angry voice. Don Abbondio interrupted him, earnestly seizing his hand, and with an imploring tone beseeching him to be quiet.
Come, don't be angry, for the love of heaven.
I'll see if in a week. And what shall I say to Lucy? Said Renzo, softening. That it has been a mistake of mine. And to the world? Say also it is my fault, that through too great haste I have made some great blunder, throw all the blame on me. Can I do more than this? Come in a week. And then there will be no further difficulties? When I say a thing. Well, I will be quiet for a week, but be assured, I will be put off with no further excuses, for the present, I take my leave. So saying, he departed, making a bow to Don Abondio less profound than usual, and giving him a look more expressive than respectful. With a heavy heart he approached the house of his betrothed, his mind dwelling on the strange conversation which had just taken place. The cold and embarrassed reception of Don Abondio, his constrained and impatient air, his mysterious hints, all combined to convince him there was still something he had not been willing to communicate. He stopped for a moment, debating with himself whether he should not return and compel him to be more frank. Raising his eyes, however, he beheld Perpetua entering a little garden a few steps distant from the house. He called to her, quickened his pace, and detaining her at the gate, endeavored to enter into discourse with her. Good day, Perpetua, I expected to have received your congratulations today. But it must be as God pleases, my poor Renzo. I want to ask a favor of you, the senior curate has offered reasons I cannot comprehend, will you explain to me the true cause why he is unable or unwilling to marry us today? Oh! You think then that I know the secrets of my master? I was right in supposing there was a mystery, thought Renzo. Come, Perpetua, continued he, we are friends, tell me what you know, help a poor young man. It is a bad thing to be born poor, my dear Renzo. That is true, replied he, still more confirmed in his suspicions that is true, but it is not becoming in the clergy to behave unjustly to the poor. Hear me, Renzo, I can tell you nothing, because I know nothing. But I can assure you my master would not wrong you or anyone, and he is not to blame. Who then is to blame? Asked Renzo, carelessly, but listening intently for a reply. I have told you already I know nothing. But I may be allowed to speak in defense of my master, poor man. If he has erred, it has been through too great kindness. There are in this world men who are overpowerful, knavish, and who fear not God. Overpowerful. Knavish. Thought Renzo, these cannot be his superiors. Come, said he, with difficulty concealing his increasing agitation. Come, tell me who it is. Ah! You would persuade me to speak, and I must not, because I know nothing. I will keep silence as faithfully as if I had promised to do so. You might put me to the torture, and you could not draw anything from me. Adieu. It is lost time for both of us. Thus saying, she re-entered the garden hastily, and shut the gate. Renzo turned very softly, lest at the noise of his footsteps she might discern the road he took. When fairly beyond her hearing, he quickened his steps, and in a moment was at the door of Don Abondio's house. He entered, rushed towards the little parlor where he had left him, and finding him still there, approached him with a bold and furious manner. What has happened now? Said Don Abondio. Who is this powerful personage? Said Renzo, with the air of one resolved to obtain an explicit answer. Who is he that forbids me to marry Lucy? What? Stammered Don Abondio, turning pale with surprise. He rose from his chair, and made an effort to reach the door. But Renzo, who expected this movement, was upon his guard, and locking the door, he put the key in his pocket. Ah! Will you speak now, senior curate? Everyone knows the affair but myself, and, by heavens, I'll know it too. Who is it, I say? Renzo, for the love of charity, take care what you do, think of your soul. I must know it at once this moment. So saying, he placed his hand on his dagger, but perhaps without intending it. Mercy! Exclaimed Don Abondio, in a stifled voice. I must know it. Who has told you? Come, no more excuses. Speak plainly and quickly. Do you mean to kill me? I mean to know that which I have a right to know. But if I speak, I die. Must I not preserve my life? Speak, then. The manner of Renzo was so threatening and decided, that Don Abondio felt there was no possibility of disobeying him. Promise me swear, said he, never to tell. Tell me quickly his name, or... At this new adjuration, the poor curate, with the trembling look of a man who feels the instrument of the dentist in his mouth, feebly articulated, Don. Don? Replied Renzo, inclining his ear towards him, eager to hear the rest. Don? Don Roderick, muttered he hastily, trembling at the sound that escaped his lips.
Ah! Dog! Shouted Renzo, and how has he done it? What has he said to you too?
What? What? Said Don Abbondio, in an almost contemptuous tone, already gaining confidence by the sacrifice he had made. I wish you were like myself, you would then meddle with nothing, and certainly you would not have had so many whims in your head. He, however, related in terrible colors the ugly encounter, his anger, which had hitherto been subdued by fear, displayed itself as he proceeded, and perceiving that Renzo, between rage and astonishment, remained motionless, with his head bent down, he continued in a lively manner, "You have made a pretty business of it, indeed. You have rendered me a notable service. Thus to attack an honest man, your curate, in his own house. In a sacred place. You have done a fine thing, truly. To wrest from my mouth, that which I concealed, from prudence, for your own good. And now that you know it, what will you do? When I gave you good advice this morning, I had judgment for you and me, but believe me, this is no jesting matter, no question of right or wrong, but superior power. At all events, open the door, give me the key."
"I may have been to blame," replied Renzo with a softened voice, but in which might be perceived smothered anger towards his concealed enemy, "I may have been to blame, but if you had been in my situation," he drew the key from his pocket, and advanced towards the door.
"Swear to me," said Don Abbondio with a serious and anxious face.
"I may have been to blame, forgive me," replied Renzo, moving to depart.
"Swear first," said Don Abbondio, holding him tremblingly by the arm.
"I may have been to blame," said Renzo, freeing himself from his grasp, and immediately springing out of the room.
"Perpetua! Perpetua!" cried Don Abbondio, after having in vain called back the fugitive. Perpetua did not answer. The poor man was so overwhelmed by his innumerable difficulties, his increasing perplexities, and so apprehensive of some fresh attack, that he conceived the idea of securing to himself a safe retreat from them all, by going to bed and giving out that he had a fever. His malady, indeed, was not altogether imaginary. The terror of the past day, the anxious watching of the night, the dread of the future, had combined to produce really the effect. Weary and stupefied, he slumbered in his large chair, muttering occasionally in a feeble but passionate voice, "Perpetua." Perpetua arrived at last with a great cabbage under her arm, and with as unconcerned a countenance as if nothing had happened. We will spare the reader the reproaches, the accusations, and denials that passed between them. It is sufficient that Don Abbondio ordered Perpetua to bolt the door, not to put her foot outside, and if anyone knocked, to reply from the window that the curate was gone to bed with a fever. He then slowly ascended the stairs and put himself really in bed, where we will leave him. Renzo, meanwhile, with hurried steps, and with a mind unsettled and distracted as to the course he should pursue, approached his home. Those who injure others are guilty, not only of the evils they commit, but also of the effects produced by these evils on the characters of the injured persons. Renzo was a quiet and peaceful youth, but now his nature appeared changed, and his thoughts dwelt only on deeds of violence. He would have run to the house of Don Roderick to assault him there, but he remembered that it was a fortress, furnished with bravos within, and well guarded without, that only those known to be friends and servants could enter without the minutest scrutiny, and that not even a tradesman could be seen there without being examined from head to foot, and he, above all, would be, alas, but too well known. He then imagined himself placed behind a hedge, with his arquebus in his hand, waiting till Roderick should pass by alone, rejoicing internally at the thought. He pictured to himself an approaching footstep, the villain appears, he takes aim, fires, and he falls, he exults a moment over his dying struggles, and then escapes for his life beyond the confines. And Lucy? This name recalled his wiser and better thoughts. He remembered the last instructions of his parents, he thought of God, the Holy Virgin, and the saints, and he tremblingly rejoiced that he had been guilty of the deed only in imagination. But how many hopes, promises, and anticipations did the idea of Lucy suggest? And this day so ardently desired. How announce to her the dreadful news? And then, what plan to pursue? How make her his own in spite of the power of this wicked lord? And now a tormenting suspicion passed through his mind. Don Roderick must have been instigated to this injury by a brutal passion for Lucy. And she? He could not for a moment endure the maddening thought that she had given him the slightest encouragement. But was she not informed of his designs? Could he have conceived his infamous purpose, and have advanced so far towards its completion, without her knowledge? And Lucy, his own beloved, had never uttered a syllable to him concerning it.
These reflections prevailing in his mind, he passed by his own house, which was situated in the center of the village, and arrived at that of Lucy, which was at the opposite extremity. It had a small courtyard in front, which separated it from the road, and which was encircled by a low wall. Entering the yard, Renzo heard a confused murmur of voices in the upper chamber. He rightly supposed it to be the wedding company, and he could not resolve to appear before them with such a countenance. A little girl, who was standing at the door, ran towards him, crying out, "The bridegroom! The bridegroom!"
"Hush, Betsy, hush," said Renzo, "come hither, go to Lucy, and whisper in her ear, but let no one hear you whisper in her ear, that I wish to speak with her in the lower chamber, and that she must come at once." The little girl hastily ascended the stairs, proud of having a secret commission to execute. Lucy had just come forth, adorned from the hands of her mother, and surrounded by her admiring friends. These were playfully endeavoring to steal a look at the blooming bride, while she, with the timidity of rustic modesty, attempted to conceal her blushing countenance with her bending arm, from beneath which a smiling mouth nevertheless appeared. Her black tresses, parted on her white forehead, were folded up in multiplied circles on the back of her head, and fastened with pins of silver, projecting on every side like the rays of the sun. This is still the custom of the Milanese peasantry. Around her throat she had a necklace of garnets, alternated with beads of gold filigree. She wore a bodice embroidered in flowers, the sleeves tied with ribbons, a short petticoat of silk, with numerous minute plates, crimson stockings, and embroidered silk slippers. But beyond all these ornaments was the modest and beautiful joy depicted on her countenance, a joy, however, troubled by a slight shade of anxiety. The little Betsy intruded herself into the circle, managed to approach Lucy, and communicated her message. "I shall return in a moment," said Lucy to her friends, as she hastily quitted the room. On perceiving the altered and unquiet appearance of Renzo, "What is the matter?" said she, not without a presentiment of evil. "Lucy," replied Renzo, "all is at a stand, and God knows whether we shall ever be man and wife."
"How?" said Lucy, alarmed. Renzo related briefly the history of the morning. She listened with anguish, when he uttered the name of Don Roderick. "Ah!" exclaimed she, blushing and trembling, "has it then come to this?"
"Then you knew?" said Renzo.
"Too well," replied Lucy.
"What did you know?"
"Do not make me speak now, do not make me weep. I'll call my mother and dismiss the company. We must be alone." As she departed, Renzo whispered, "And you have never spoken of it to me."
"Ah, Renzo,"
replied Lucy, turning for a moment to gaze at him. He understood well what this action meant. It was as if she had said, "Can you doubt me?" Meanwhile, the good Agnes, so the mother of Lucy was called, had descended the stairs, to ascertain the cause of her daughter's disappearance. She remained with Renzo, while Lucy returned to the company, and, assuming all the composure she could, said to them, "The senior curate is indisposed, and the wedding cannot take place today." The ladies departed, and lost no time in relating amongst the gossips of the neighborhood all that had occurred, while they made particular inquiries respecting the reality of Don Abbondio's sickness. The truth of this cut short the conjectures which they had already begun to intimate by brief and mysterious hints. Chapter 3. Lucy entered the lower room as Renzo was sorrowfully informing Agnes of that, to which she as sorrowfully listened. Both turned towards her, from whom they expected an explanation which could not but be painful. The suspicions of both were, however, excited in the midst of their grief, and the displeasure they felt towards Lucy differed only according to their relative situation. Agnes, although anxious to hear her daughter speak, could not avoid reproaching her to say nothing to thy mother.
"Now, I will tell you all," said Lucy, wiping her eyes with her apron.
"Speak, speak," cried at once her mother and her lover.
"Holy Virgin," exclaimed Lucy, "that it should come to this." And with a voice interrupted by tears, she related that a few days previously, as she returned from weaving, and was loitering behind her companions, Don Roderick came up with her, in company with another gentleman, that the former sought to engage her in idle conversation, that she quickened her pace, without lending him an ear, and rejoined her companions. In the meanwhile she heard the other gentleman laugh, and Don Roderick say, "I'll lay a wager with you." The day following, on their return, they met them again, but Lucy kept in the midst of her companions, with her head down. The other gentleman burst into laughter, and Don Roderick said, "We will see, we will see." "Happily for me," continued Lucy, "this day was the last of the weaving. I related the adventure immediately."
"To whom didst thou relate it?" asked Agnes quickly, indignant at the idea of any one being preferred before her as a confidant.
"To Father Christopher, in confession, mamma," replied Lucy,
in a tone of apology. I told him all, the last time you and I went to the church of the convent, you may perhaps recollect my contrivances for delay on that morning, until there should pass some villagers in whose company we might go into the street, because I was so afraid. The indignation of Agnes subsided at once, at the mention of a name so revered as Father Christopher's. Thou didst well, my child, said she, but why not tell it also to thy mother? For this, Lucy had two very good reasons, the one, a desire not to disturb and frighten her mother with a circumstance she could not have prevented, the other, the dread of placing a secret, which she wished to be buried in her own bosom in danger of becoming known to all the village. Of these two reasons she only alleged the first. And could I, said she, turning to Renzo, in a gentle and reproachful voice, could I speak to you of this? Alas! That you should know it now. And what did the father say to you? Asked Agnes. He told me to endeavor to hasten my nuptials, and in the meanwhile to keep myself within doors, to pray much to God, and he hoped that if Don Roderick should not see me, he would cease to think of me. And it was then, continued she, turning again towards Renzo, without, however, raising her eyes, and blushing deeply, it was then that I compelled myself, at the risk of appearing very forward, to request you to conclude the marriage before the appointed time. Who can tell what you must have thought of me? But I did it for the best, and from advice and this morning I little thought, she could articulate no longer, and burst into a flood of tears. Ah! The scoundrel! The villain! Exclaimed Renzo, pacing the room in a violent paroxysm of rage. He stopped suddenly before Lucy, regarded her with a countenance agitated by various passions, and said, "This is the last wicked deed this wretch will perform." "Ah! No, Renzo, for the love of heaven!" cried Lucy, "no, no, for the love of heaven. There is a God who watches over the oppressed, but do you think he will protect us if we do evil?" "No, no, for the love of heaven!" repeated Agnes. "Renzo," said Lucy, with a more resolved and tranquil air, "you have a trade, and I know how to work. Let us go away into some distant place, that he may hear of us no more." "Ah, Lucy! But we are not yet man and wife. If we were married, then, indeed," Lucy relapsed into tears, and all three remained silent. The deep despondency of their countenances formed a mournful contrast to the festive character of their dress. "Hear me, my children, listen to me," said Agnes, after a few moments. "I came into the world before you, and I know it a little better than you do. The devil is not so frightful as they paint him. To us poor people the skeins appear more entangled, because we do not know where to look for the end, but sometimes advice from a learned man, I know what I mean to say. Do as I tell you, Renzo, go to Lecco, find the doctor _Azekagarbulii_, relate to him, but you must not call him by this name, it is a nickname. Say to the doctor, what do they call him? Oh dear! I can't think of his real name, everyone calls him _Azekagarbulii_. Well, well, find this tall, stiff, bald doctor, with a red nose, and a face as red. I know the man by sight, said Renzo. Well, very well, continued Agnes, there's a man for you. I have seen more than one troubled wretch who did not know which way to turn himself. I have known him remain an hour with the doctor _Azekagarbulii_, be careful you don't call him so, and go away laughing at himself for his uneasiness. Take with you these fowls, I expected to have wrung their necks, poor little things. For the banquet of tonight, however, carry them to him, because one must never go empty-handed to these gentlemen. Relate to him all that has happened, and he will tell you at once that which would never enter our heads in a year." Renzo and Lucy approved of this advice. Agnes, proud of having given it, with great complacency took the poor fowls one by one from the coop, tied their legs together as if she were making a nosegay, and consigned them to his hands. After having exchanged words of hope, he departed, avoiding the high road and crossing the fields, so as not to attract notice. As he went along, he had leisure to dwell on his misfortunes, and revolve in his mind his anticipated interview with the doctor _Azekagarbulii_. I leave a reader to imagine the condition of the unfortunate fowls swinging by the legs with their heads downwards in the hands of a man agitated by all the tumults of passion, and whose arm moved more in accordance with the violence of his feelings, than with sympathy for the unhappy animals whose heads became conscious of sundry terrific shocks, which they resented by pecking at one another, a practice too frequent with companions in misfortune. He arrived at the village, asked for the house of the doctor, which being pointed out to him, he proceeded thither. On entering, he experienced the timidity so common to the poor and illiterate at the near approach to the learned and noble. He forgot all the speeches he had prepared, but giving a glance at the fowls, he took courage. He entered the kitchen, and demanded of the maidservant, if he could speak with the senior doctor? As if accustomed to similar gifts, she immediately took the fowls out of his hand, although Renzo drew them back, wishing the doctor to know that it was he who brought them. The doctor entered as the maid was saying, "Give here, and pass into the study." Renzo bowed low to him, he replied with a kind "Come in, my son," and led the way into an adjoining chamber. This was a large room, on the three walls of which were distributed portraits of the 12 Caesars, while the fourth was covered with a large bookcase of old and dusty books. In the middle stood a table laden with memorials, libels, and proclamations, with three or four seats around. On one side of it was a large armchair with a high and square back, terminated at each corner by ornaments of wood in the fashion of horns. The nails which had fallen out here and there from its leathern covering, left the corners of it at liberty to roll themselves up in all directions. The doctor was in his morning gown, that is, enveloped in a faded toga, which had served him long since to appear in at Milan, on some great occasion. He closed the door, and encouraged the young man with these words, "My son, tell me your case. I wish to speak a word to you in confidence." "Well, say on," replied the doctor, as he seated himself in the armchair. Renzo stood before the table twirling his hat in his hand, and began, "I wish to know from one as learned as yourself." "Tell me the affair just as it is," interrupted the doctor, "in as few words as possible." "You must pardon me, senior doctor, we poor people know not how to speak to such as you are. I wish then to know." "Bless the people. They are all alike, instead of relating facts, they ask questions, and that because their own opinions are already settled." "Excuse me, senior doctor. I wish, then, to know if there is a punishment for threatening a curate, to prevent him from performing a marriage ceremony?" "I understand," said the doctor, who in truth had understood "I understand." And suddenly assuming an air of seriousness and importance, "A serious case, my son, a case contemplated. You have done well to come to me, it is a clear case, noticed in 100 proclamations, and in one, of the year just elapsed, by the actual governor. You shall see, you shall see." "Where can it be?" said he, plunging his hand amidst the chaos of papers. "It must surely be here, as it is a decree of great importance. Ah! Here it is, here it is." He unfolded it, looked at the date, and with a serious face exclaimed, "15th of October, 1627. "Yes, yes, this is it, a new edict, these are those which cause terror. Do you know how to read, my son?" "A little, senior doctor." "Well now, come behind me, and you will see for yourself." Holding the proclamation extended before him, he began to read, stammering rapidly over some passages, and pausing distinctly with great expression on others, according to the necessity of the case. Although by the proclamation published by order of the Signor Duke di Feria, on the 14th of December, 1620, and ratified by the most illustrious, and most excellent Lord, Signor Gonzalez Fernandez de Cordovicama had by extraordinary and rigorous remedies provided against the oppressions, exactions, and other tyrannical acts committed against the devoted vassals of His Majesty, the frequency of the excesses, however, has arrived at such a point that His Excellency is under the necessity, wherefore, with the concurrence of the Senate and Convention, has resolved to publish the present decree. And from the tyrannical acts which the skill of many in the villages, as well as in the cities, do you hear exact and oppress the weak in various ways, making violent contracts of purchase, of rent, Where is it? Ah! Here it is, listen, listen, who, whether matrimony follow or not, Ah! That's my case, said Renzo. Listen, listen, here is more, now we will find the punishment. That they leave the place of their abode, that if one pays a debt he must not be molested, All this has nothing to do with us. Ah! Here it is. The priest refusing to do that to which he is obliged by his office, It appears the proclamation was made purposely for me. Ah! Is it not so? Listen, listen. And other similar oppressions which flow from the vassals, nobility, middle and lower classes, none escape, they are all here, it is like the valley of Jehoshaphat. Hear now the penalty, for all these and other similar evil deeds, which having been prohibited, it is nevertheless necessary to exact with rigor, His Excellency, not annulling, orders and commands, that whoever the offenders be, they shall be subjected to pecuniary and corporal punishment, to banishment, the galleys, or to death underscore, a mere trifle, underscore, at the will of His Excellency, or of the Senate. And from this there is no escape underscore, and see. And see. And see here the signature, underscore Gonzalez Fernandez de Cordova underscore, and lower down, underscore Platanas underscore, and here again, underscore Vedette Farrar underscore, nothing is wanting. Whilst the doctor was reading, Renzo had kept his eyes on the paper, seeking to ascertain for himself its real meaning. The doctor, perceiving his new client more attentive than dismayed, marveled greatly. He must be enrolled as one of the bravos, said he to himself. Ah! Ah! Exclaimed he, addressing Renzo, you have shaved off the long lock. Well, well, it was prudent, but placing yourself in my hands, you need not have done so. The case is a serious one. You can have no idea how much resolution is required to conduct these matters wisely. To understand this mistake of the doctor's, it should be known that the bravos by profession used to wear a long lock of hair, which they pulled over the face as a mask in enterprises that required prudence as well as strength. The proclamation had not been silent with regard to this custom. Underscore His Excellency commands that whosoever shall wear hair of such a length as to cover the forehead to the eyebrows will incur the penalty of a fine of 300 crowns, in case of incapability of payment, 3 years in the galleys for the first offence, and for the second, in addition to the aforesaid, greater punishments still, at the will of His Excellency. Underscore The long lock had become a distinctive mark of the loose and disorderly. Indeed, indeed, replied Renzo, I have never worn a long lock in my life. I can do nothing, replied the doctor, shaking his head, with a knowing and rather impatient smile, nothing, if you do not trust me. He who utters falsehoods to the doctor is a fool who will tell the truth to the judge. It is necessary to relate things plainly to the lawyer, but it rests with us to render them more intricate. If you wish me to help you, you must tell all from beginning to end. As to your confessor, you must name the person who commissioned you to do the deed. Doubtless he is a person of consequence, and, considering this, I will go to his house to perform an act of duty. I will not betray you at all, be assured. I will tell him I come to implore his protection for a poor calumniated youth, and we will together use the necessary means to finish the affair in a satisfactory manner. You understand, in securing himself, he will likewise secure you. If, however, the business has been all your own, I will not withdraw my protection. I have extricated others from worse difficulties, provided you have not offended a person of underscore consequence underscore. You understand I engage to free you from all embarrassment, with a little expense, you understand. As to the curate, if he is a person of judgment, he will keep his own counsel. If he is a fool, we will take care of him. One may escape clear out of every trouble, but for this, a underscore man underscore is necessary. Your case is a very, very serious one. The edict speaks plainly, and if the thing rested between you and the law, to be candid, it would go hard with you. If you wish to pass smoothly, money and obedience. Whilst the doctor poured forth this rhapsody, Renzo had been regarding him with mute astonishment, as the countryman watches the juggler, whom he sees cramming his mouth with handful after handful of tow, when, lo! He beholds immediately drawn forth from the same mouth a never-ending line of riband. When at last he perceived his meaning, he interrupted him with, Oh! Senior doctor, how you have misunderstood me! The matter is directly the reverse. I have threatened no one, not I never do such things. Ask my companions, all of them, and they will tell you I never had anything to do with the law. The injury is mine, and I have come to you to know how I can obtain justice, and am well satisfied to have seen this proclamation. The devil! Exclaimed the doctor, opening wide his eyes, what a cock and a bull story you have made. So it is, you are all alike. Is it possible you can't tell a plain fact? But, senior doctor, you must pardon me, you have not given me time, now I will tell you all. No, then, that I was to have been married today, and here his voice trembled, was to have been married today to a young person to whom I have been some time betrothed. Today was the day fixed upon by the senior curate, and everything was in readiness. The senior curate began to make excuses, and not to weary you I compelled him to tell me the cause, and he confessed that he had been forbidden, on pain of death, to perform the ceremony. This powerful Don Roderick. A. Hastily interrupted the doctor, contracting his brow and wrinkling his red nose, away with you. What have I to do with these idle stories? Tell them to your companions, and not to one of my condition. Be gone. Do you think I have nothing to do but listen to tales of this sort? I protest. Be gone, I say, what have I to do with your protestations? I wash my hands from them. And pacing the room, he rubbed his hands together, as if really performing that act. Hereafter learn when to speak, and do not take a gentleman by surprise. But hear me, vainly repeated Renzo. The doctor, still growling, pushed him towards the door, set it wide open, called the maid, and said to her, return this man immediately what he brought, I will have nothing to do with it. The woman had never before been required to execute a similar order, but she did not hesitate to obey. She took the fowls and gave them to Renzo with a compassionate look, as if she had said, you certainly have made some very great blunder. Renzo wished to make apologies, but the doctor was immovable. Confounded, therefore, and more enraged than ever, he took back the fowls and departed, to render an account of the ill success of his expedition. At his departure, Agnes and Lucy had exchanged their nuptial robes for their humble daily habits, and then, sorrowful and dejected, occupied themselves in suggesting fresh projects. Agnes expected great results from Renzo's visit to the doctor. Lucy thought that it would be well to let Father Christopher know what had happened, as he was a man who would not only advise, but assist whenever he could serve the unfortunate. Agnes assented, but how was it to be accomplished? The convent was 2 miles distant, and at this time certainly could neither of them hazard a walk thither. Whilst they were weighing the difficulties, someone knocked at the door, and they heard a low but distinct Dio gracias . Lucy, imagining who it was, hastened to open it, and, bowing low, there entered a Capuchin collector of contributions, with his wallet swung over his left shoulder. Oh! Brother Galdino! Said Agnes. The Lord be with you, said the brother, I come for your contribution of nuts. Go, get the nuts for the fathers, said Agnes. Lucy obeyed, but before she quitted the room, she gave her mother a kind and impressive look, as much as to say, be secret. The Capuchin, looking significantly at Agnes, said, and the wedding? It was to have taken place today, what has happened? The curate is sick, and we are obliged to defer it, replied the dame, in haste, but what success in the contributions? Continued she, anxious to change the subject, which she would willingly have prolonged, but for Lucy's earnest look. Very poor, good dame, very poor. This is all, said he, swinging the wallet from his shoulder. This is all, and for this I have been obliged to knock at 10 doors. But the year is a scarce one, Brother Galdino, and when we have to struggle for bread, our alms are necessarily small. If we wish abundance to return, my good dame, we must give alms. Do you not know the miracle of the nuts, which happened many years ago in our convent of Romagna? No, in truth, tell me. Well, you must know, then, that in this convent there was one of our fathers who was a saint. He was called Father Macario. One winter's day, passing by a field of one of our patrons, a worthy man he was, he saw him standing near a large nut tree, and 4 peasants with their axes raised to level it to the ground. What are you doing to the poor tree? Demanded Father Macario. Why, Father, it is unfruitful, and I am about to cut it down. Do not do so, do not do so, said the father, I tell you that next year it will bear more nuts than leaves. The master ordered the workmen to throw at once the earth on the roots which had been already bared, and, calling after the Father Macario, said, Father Macario, the half of the crop shall be for the convent. The prediction was noised about, and everyone went to look at the tree. In fact, when spring arrived, there were flowers in abundance, and afterwards nuts in abundance. But there was a greater miracle yet, as you shall hear. The owner, who, before the nut season, was called hence to enjoy the fruits of his charity, left a son of a very different character from himself. Now, at the time of harvest, the collector went to receive his appointed portion, but the son affected entire ignorance, and presumptuously replied, he never had understood that the Capuchins knew how to make nuts. Now guess what happened then. One day he had invited to dinner some friends, and, making merry, he amused them with the story of the nuts. They desired to visit his granary, to behold his abundance. He led the way, advanced towards the corner where they had been placed, looked, and what do you think he saw? A heap of dry nut leaves. Was not this a miracle? And the convent gained, instead of suffering loss, the profusion of nuts bestowed upon it in consequence was so great, that one of our patrons, compassionating the poor collector, gave him a mule to assist in carrying them home. And so much oil was made, that it was freely given to the poor, like the sea, which receives waters from every part, and distributes abundantly to the rivers. Lucy now reappeared with her apron so loaded with nuts, that she could with difficulty support the burthen. Whilst Friar Galdino untied his wallet to receive them, Agnes cast an astonished and displeased glance at her for her prodigality. She returned it with a look which seemed to say, "I will satisfy you." The friar was liberal of thanks, and, replacing his wallet, was about to depart, when Lucy called him back. "I wish you to do me a service," said she. "I wish you to say to Father Christopher that I have a great desire to speak with him, and request him to have the goodness to come hither immediately, as it is impossible for me to go to the convent." "Willingly, an hour shall not elapse before Father Christopher shall be informed of your wish." "I rely on you." "Trust me," said he, "I will be faithful," and moved off, bending under the increased weight of his wallet. We must not suppose, from the readiness with which Lucy sent this request to Father Christopher, and the equal readiness of Father Galdino to carry it, that the father was a person of no consequence. On the contrary, he was a man of much authority amongst his companions, and throughout all the neighborhood. To serve the feeble, and to be served by the powerful, to enter the palace and the hut, to be at one time a subject of pastime, and at another regarded with profound respect, to seek alms, and to bestow them, to all these vicissitudes a Capuchin was well accustomed. The name of _Friar_, at this period, was uttered with the greatest respect, and with the most bitter contempt, of both of which sentiments, perhaps, the Capuchins were, more than any other order, the objects. They possessed no property, wore a coarser habit than others, and made a more open profession of humility. They therefore exposed themselves, in a greater degree, to the veneration or the scorn which might result from the various characters among men. "The Friar Galdino being gone, such a quantity of nuts!" exclaimed Agnes, "and in a year of scarcity." "I beg pardon," replied Lucy, "but if we had been as penurious as others in our charity, who can tell how long the friar would have been in reaching home, or, amongst all the gossipings, whether he would have remembered?" "True, true, it was a good thought, and besides, charity always produces good fruit," said Agnes, who, with all her defects, was a kind-hearted woman, and would have sacrificed everything she had in the world for the sake of her child, in whom she had reposed all her happiness. Renzo entered at this moment, with an angry and mortified countenance. "Pretty advice you gave me," said he to Agnes. "You sent me to a fine man, indeed. To one truly who aids the distressed." And he briefly related his interview with the doctor. The dame, astonished at the issue, endeavored to prove that the advice was good, and that the failure must have been owing to Renzo himself. Lucy interrupted the debate, by informing him of her message to Father Christopher. He seized with avidity the new hopes inspired by the expectation of assistance from so holy a man. "But if the father," said he, "should not extricate us from our difficulties, I will do it myself by some means or other." Both mother and daughter implored him to be patient and prudent. "Tomorrow," said Lucy, "Father Christopher will certainly be here, and he will no doubt suggest to us some plan of action which we ourselves would not have thought of in a year." "I hope so," said Renzo, "but if not, I will obtain redress, or find another to do it for me, for surely there must be justice to be had in the world." Their mournful conversation might have continued much longer, but approaching night warned him to depart. "Good night," said Lucy mournfully, to Renzo, who could hardly resolve to go. "Good night," replied he, yet more sadly. "Some saint will watch over us," said she. "Be patient and prudent." The mother added some advice of the like nature. But the disappointed bridegroom, with the tempest in his heart, left them, repeating the strange proposition, "Surely, there's justice in the world." So true is it that, under the influence of great misfortune, men no longer know what they say. Chapter 4. The sun had not yet risen above the horizon, when Father Christopher left the convent of Pescarinico, to go to the cottage where he was so anxiously expected. Pescarinico is a small hamlet on the left bank of the Adda, or, rather, of the lake, a few steps below the bridge, a group of houses, inhabited for the most part by fishermen, and adorned here and there with nets spread out to dry. The convent was situated, the building still subsists, at a short distance from them, halfway between Lecco and Bergamo. The sky was clear and serene. As the sun rose behind the mountain, its rays brightened the opposite summits, and thence rapidly spread themselves over the declivities and valleys. A light autumn breeze played through the leaves of the mulberry trees, and brought them to the ground. The vineyards were still brilliant with leaves of various hues, and the newly made nets appeared brown and distinct amid the fields of stubble, which were white and shining with the dew. The scene was beautiful, but the misery of the inhabitants formed a sad contrast to it. At every moment you met pale and ragged beggars, some grown old in the trade, others youthful, and induced to it from extreme necessity. They passed quietly by Father Christopher, and although they had nothing to hope from him, since a Capuchin never touches money, They bowed low in thanks for the alms they had received, or might hereafter receive at the convent. The spectacle of the laborers scattered in the fields was still more mournful. Some were sowing thinly and sparingly their seed, as if hazarding that which was too precious, others put the spade into the earth with difficulty, and wearily turned up the clods. The pale and sickly child was leading the meager cattle to the pasture ground, and as he went along plucked carefully the herbs found in his path, as food for his family. This melancholy picture of human misery increased the sadness of Father Christopher, who, when he left the convent, had been filled with presentiments of evil. But why did he feel so much for Lucy? And why, at the first notice, did he hasten to her with as much solicitude as if he had been sent for by the Father Provincial? And who is this Father Christopher? We must endeavor to satisfy all these inquiries. Father Christopher, of Dash, was a man nearer 60 than 50 years of age. His head was shaven, with the exception of the band of hair allowed to grow round it like a crown, as was the custom of the Capuchins. The expression of his countenance was habitually that of deep humility, although occasionally there passed over it flashes of pride and inquietude, which were, however, succeeded by a deeper shade of self-reproach and lowliness. His long gray beard gave more character to the shape of the upper part of his head, on which habitual abstinence had stamped a strong expression of gravity. His sunken eyes were for the most part bent to the earth, but brightened at times with unexpected vivacity, which he ever appeared to endeavor to repress. His name, before entering the convent, had been Ludovico. He was the son of a merchant of Dash, who, having accumulated great wealth, had renounced trade in the latter part of his life, and having resolved to live like a gentleman, he studied every means to cause his former mode of life to be forgotten by those around him. He could not, however, forget it himself. The shop, the goods, the daybook, the yard measure, rose to his memory, like the shade of Banquo to Macbeth, amidst the pomp of the table and the smiles of his parasites, whose continual effort it was to avoid any word which might appear to allude to the former condition of the host. Ludovico was his only child. He caused him to be nobly educated, as far as the laws and customs permitted him to do so, and died, bequeathing him a splendid fortune. Ludovico had contracted the habits and feelings of a gentleman, and the flatterers who had surrounded him from infancy had accustomed him to the greatest deference and respect. But he found the scene changed when he attempted to mingle with the nobility of the city, and that in order to live in their company he must school himself to patience and submission, and bear with contumely on every occasion. This agreed neither with his education nor his disposition. He retired from them in disgust, but unwillingly, feeling that such should naturally have been his companions. He then resolved to outdo them in pomp and magnificence, thereby increasing the enmity with which they had already regarded him. His open and violent nature soon engaged him in more serious contests. He sincerely abhorred the extortions and injuries committed by those to whom he had opposed himself. He therefore habitually took part with the weak against the powerful, so that by degrees he had constituted himself the defender of the oppressed, and the vindicator of their wrongs. The office was onerous, and fruitful in evil thoughts, quarrels, and enmities against himself. But, besides this external warfare, he perhaps suffered still more from inward conflicts, for often, in order to compass his objects, he was obliged to adopt measures of circumvention and violence, which his conscience disapproved. He was under the painful necessity of keeping in pay a band of ruffians for his own security, as well as to aid him in his enterprises, and for these purposes he was necessarily obliged to select the boldest, that is, the vilest, and to live with vagabonds from a love of justice, so that, disgusted with the world and its conflicts, he had many times seriously thought of entering some monastery, and retiring from it forever. Such intentions were more strongly entertained on the failure of some of his enterprises, or the perception of his own danger, or the annoyance of his vicious associates, and would probably have still continued _intentions_, but for one of the most serious and terrible events of his hazardous mode of life. He was walking one day through the streets of the city, accompanied by a former shopman, who had been transformed by his father into a steward, followed by two bravos. The name of the shopman was Christopher. He was a man about 50 years of age, devoted to the master whom he had tended in infancy, and upon whose liberality he supported himself, his wife, and a large family of children. Ludovico saw a gentleman approaching at a distance, with whom he had never spoken in his life, but whom he hated for his arrogance and pride, which hatred the other cordially returned. He had in his train four bravos. He advanced with a haughty step, and an expression of insolence and disdain on his countenance. It was Ludovico's right, being on the left side, to pass nearest the wall, according to the custom of the day, and everyone was tenacious of this privilege. As they met, they stopped face to face, like two figures on a bas relief, neither of them being disposed to yield to the other. The gentleman, Ing Ludovico proudly and imperiously, said, with a corresponding tone of voice, pass on the outside.
Pass there yourself, replied Ludovico, the street is mine.
With persons of your condition the street is always mine.
Yes, if your arrogance were a law to others.
The attendants of each stood still, with their hands on their daggers, prepared for battle. The passers-by retreated to a distance to watch the event.
Pass on, vile mechanic, or I will teach you the civility due to a gentleman.
You lie, I am not vile.
Ha! Do you give me the lie? If you were a gentleman I would soon settle matters with my sword.
You are a coward also, or you would not hesitate to support by deeds the insolence of your words.
Throw this rascal in the dirt, said the gentleman, turning to his followers.
Let us see who will dare to do so, said Ludovico, stepping back and laying his hand on his sword.
Rash man, cried the other, unsheathing his own, I will break this in pieces when it shall have been stained with your base blood.
They rushed violently on each other, the servants of both sprang to the defense of their masters. The combat was unequal in numbers, and also unequal from Ludovico's desire to defend himself rather than to wound his enemy, whilst the latter intended nothing less than murder.
Ludovico was warding off the dagger of one of the bravos, after having received a slight scratch on the cheek, when his enemy thrust at him from behind. Christopher, seeing his master's peril, went to his assistance. Upon this the anger of the enraged cavalier was turned against the shopman, and he thrust him through the heart with his sword.
Ludovico, as if beside himself at the sight, buried his weapon in the breast of the murderer, who fell almost at the same instant with the poor Christopher. The attendants of the gentleman, beholding him on the ground, took to flight, and Ludovico found himself alone, in the midst of a crowd, with two bodies lying at his feet.
What has happened?
One too he has been thrust through the body.
Who is killed?
A nobleman.
Holy Virgin.
What destruction?
Who seeks, finds.
A moment pays all.
What a wound.
It must have been a serious affair.
And this unfortunate man.
Mercy.
What a spectacle.
Save, save him.
It will go hard with him also.
See how he is wounded, he is covered with blood.
Escape, poor man, escape, do not let yourself be taken.
These words expressed the common suffrage, and with advice came also assistance. The affair had taken place near a church of the Capuchins, an asylum impenetrable to the officers of justice. The murderer, bleeding and stupefied, was carried thither by the crowd. The brotherhood received him from their hands with this recommendation: he is an honest man who has made a proud rascal cold, but he did it in his own defense.
Ludovico had never before shed blood, and although in these times murder was a thing so common that all ceased to wonder at it, yet the impression which he received from the recollection of the dying through his instrumentality, was new and indescribable, a revelation of feelings hitherto unknown.
The fall of his enemy, the alteration of those features, passing in a moment from angry threatenings to the solemn stillness of death, this was a spectacle which wrought an instantaneous change in the soul of the murderer.
Whilst they were carrying him to the convent he had been insensible to what was passing. Returning to his senses, he found himself in a bed of the infirmary, in the hands of a friar who was dressing his wounds.
Another, whose particular duty it was to administer comfort to the dying, had been called to the scene of combat.
He returned in a short time, and approaching Ludovico's bed, said, "Console yourself, he has died in peace, has forgiven you, and hoped for your forgiveness."
At these words the soul of Ludovico was filled with remorse and sorrow.
"And the other?"
asked he anxiously.
"The other had expired before I arrived."
In the meantime the avenues and environs of the convent swarmed with people. The officers of justice arrived, dispersed the crowd, and placed themselves in ambush at a short distance from the gates, so that no one could pass through them unobserved. A brother of the deceased and some of his family appeared in full armor with a large attendance of bravos, and surrounded the place, watching with a threatening aspect the bystanders, who did not dare say, "He is safe," but they had it written on their faces.
Scarcely had Ludovico recalled his scattered thoughts, when he asked for a father confessor, prayed him to seek out the widow of Christopher, to ask forgiveness in his name for having been, however involuntarily, the cause of her affliction, and to assure her that he would take the care of her family on himself.
Reflecting further on his own situation, his determination was made to become a friar. It seemed as if God himself had willed it, by placing him in a convent at such a conjuncture. He immediately sent for the superior of the monastery, and expressed to him his intention.
He replied to him, that he should be careful not to form a resolution precipitately, but that, if he persisted, he would be accepted.
Ludovico then sent for a notary, and made a donation of all his estate to the widow and family of Christopher. The resolution of Ludovico happened opportunely for his hosts, who felt themselves embarrassed concerning him. To send him from the monastery, and thus expose him to justice and the vengeance of his enemies, was not to be thought of a moment. It would be the same as a renunciation of their privileges, a discrediting of the convent amongst the people, and they would draw upon themselves the animadversion of all the Capuchins of the universe for this relinquishment of the rights of the order, this defiance of the ecclesiastical authorities, who then considered themselves the guardians of these rights. On the other hand, the family of the deceased, rich and powerful in adherents, were determined on vengeance, and disposed to consider as enemies whoever should place obstacles to its accomplishment. History declares, not that they grieved much for the dead, or that a single tear was shed for him amongst his whole race, but that they were urged on by scenting the blood of his opponent. But Ludovico, by assuming the habit of a Capuchin, removed all difficulties. To a certain degree he made atonement, imposed on himself penitence, confessed his fault, withdrew from the contest. He was, in short, an enemy who laid down his arms. The relations of the deceased could, if they pleased, believe and boast that he had become a friar through despair and dread of their revenge. And at all events, to reduce a man to dispossess himself of his wealth, to shave his head, to walk barefooted, to sleep on straw, and to live on alms, might appear a punishment competent to the offense. The superior presented himself before the brother of the deceased with an air of humility, after a thousand protestations of respect for his illustrious house, and of desire to comply with its wishes as far as was practicable. He spoke of the repentance and resolution of Ludovico, politely hoping that the family would grant their accordance, and then insinuating, mildly and dexterously, that, agreeable or not agreeable, the thing would take place. After some little vaporing, he agreed to it on one condition, that the murderer of his brother should depart immediately from the city. To this the Capuchin assented, as if in obedience to the wishes of the family, although it had been already so determined. The affair was thus concluded to the satisfaction of the illustrious house, of the Capuchin brotherhood, of the popular feeling, and, above all, of our generous penitent himself. Thus, at 30 years of age, Ludovico bade farewell to the world, and having, according to custom, to change his name, he took one which would continually recall to him his crime. Thus he became _ Friar Christopher_. Hardly was the ceremony of assuming the habit completed, when the superior informed him he must depart on the morrow to perform his novitiate at Dash, 60 miles distance. The novitiate bowed submissively. "Permit me, father," said he, "before I leave the scene of my crime, to do all that rests with me now to repair the evil. Permit me to go to the house of the brother of him whom I have murdered, to acknowledge my fault, and ask forgiveness. Perhaps God will take away his but too just resentment." It appeared to the superior that such an act, besides being praiseworthy in itself, would serve still more to reconcile the family to the monastery. He therefore bore the request himself to the brother of the murdered man. A proposal so unexpected was received with a mixture of scorn and complacency. "Let him come tomorrow," said he, and appointed the hour. The superior returned to Father Christopher with the desired permission. The gentleman reflected that the more solemn and public the apology was, the more it would enhance his credit with the family and the world. He made known in haste to the members of the family that on the following day they should assemble at his house to receive a common satisfaction. At midday the palace swarmed with nobility of either sex. There was a blending of veils, feathers, and jewels, a heavy motion of starched and crisped bands, a confused entangling of embroidered trains. The antechambers, the courts, and the street were crowded with servants, pages, and bravos. Father Christopher experienced a momentary agitation at beholding all this preparation, but recovering himself, said, "It is well. The deed was committed in public, the reparation should be public." Then, with his eyes bent to the earth, and the father, his companion, at his elbow, he crossed the court, amidst a crowd who eyed him with unceremonious curiosity. He entered, ascended the stairs, and passing through another crowd of lords, who made way for him at his approach, he advanced towards the master of the mansion, who stood in the middle of the room waiting to receive him, with downcast looks, grasping with one hand the hilt of his sword, and with the other pressing the cape of his Spanish cloak on his breast. The countenance and deportment of Father Christopher made an immediate impression on the company, so that all were convinced that he had not submitted to this humiliation from fear of man. He threw himself on his knees before him whom he had most injured, crossed his hands on his breast, and bending his head, exclaimed, "I am the murderer of your brother. God knows, that to restore him to life I would sacrifice my own, but as this cannot be, I supplicate you to accept my useless and late apology, for the love of God." All eyes were fixed in breathless and mute attention on the novice, and on the person to whom he addressed himself. There was heard through the crowd a murmur of pity and respect. The angry scorn of the nobleman relaxed at this appeal, and bending towards the kneeling supplicant, "Rise," said he, with a troubled voice. "The offense that deed truly but the habit you wear not only this but on your own account rise, father. My brother I cannot deny it was a cavalier of a hasty temper. Do not speak of it again. But, father, you must not remain in this posture." And he took him by the arm to raise him. Father Christopher, standing with his eyes still bent to the ground, continued, "I may, then, hope that you have granted me your pardon. And if I obtain it from you, from whom may I not expect it? Oh! If I could hear you utter the word. Pardon," said the nobleman, "I pardon you with all my heart, and all," turning to the company, "all, all," resounded at once through the room. The countenance of the father expanded with joy, under which, however, was still visible an humble and profound compunction for the evil, which the remission of men could not repair. The nobleman, entirely vanquished, threw his arms around his neck, and the kiss of peace was given and received. Loud exclamations of applause burst from the company, and all crowded eagerly around the father. In the meanwhile the servants entered, bearing refreshments. The master of the mansion, again addressing Father Christopher, said, "Father, afford me a proof of your friendship by accepting some of these trifles." "Such things are no longer for me," replied the father, "but if you will allow me a loaf of bread, as a memorial of your charity and your forgiveness, I shall be thankful." The bread was brought, and with an air of humble gratitude he put it in his basket. He then took leave of the company, disentangled himself with difficulty from the crowd in the antechambers, who would have kissed the hem of his garment, and pursued his way to the gate of the city, whence he commenced his pedestrian journey towards the place of his novitiate. It is not our design to write the history of his cloistral life. We will only say, he executed faithfully the offices ordinarily assigned to him, of preaching, and of comforting the dying, but beyond these, the oppressor's wrongs, the proud man's contumely, aroused in him a spirit of resistance which humiliation and remorse had not been able entirely to extinguish. His countenance was habitually mild and humble, but occasionally there passed over it a shade of former impetuosity, which was with difficulty restrained by the high and holy motives which now predominated in his soul. His tone of voice was gentle as his countenance, but in the cause of justice and truth, his language assumed a character of solemnity and emphasis singularly impressive. One who knew him well, and admired his virtues, could often perceive, by the smothered utterance or the change of a single word, the inward conflict between the natural impetus and the resolved will, which latter never failed to gain the mastery. If one unknown to him in the situation of Lucy had implored his assistance, he would have granted it immediately, with how much more solicitude, then, did he direct his steps to the cottage, knowing and admiring her innocence, trembling for her danger, and experiencing a lively indignation at the persecution of which she had become the object. Besides, he had advised her to remain quiet, and not make known the conduct of her persecutor, and he felt or feared that his advice might have been productive of bad consequences. His anxiety for her welfare, and his inadequate means to secure it, called up many painful feelings, which the good often experience. But while we have been relating his history, he arrived at the dwelling. Agnes and her daughter advanced eagerly towards him, exclaiming in one breath, "Oh! Father Christopher, you are welcome." Chapter 5. Father Christopher perceived immediately, from the countenances of Lucy and her mother, that some evil had occurred. "Is all well with you?" said he. Lucy replied by a flood of tears. "Quiet yourself, poor child," continued he, "and do you," turning to Agnes, "tell me what is the matter." Whilst the good dame proceeded with the melancholy relation, he experienced a variety of painful emotions. The story being done, he buried his face in his hands, and exclaimed, "Oh, blessed God! How long?" He then turned to Lucy, "Poor child! God has, indeed, visited you," said he. "You will not abandon us, father?" said Lucy, sobbing. "Abandon you?" replied he. "How should I dare ask the protection of Almighty God for myself, if I abandoned you, so defenseless? You, whom he has confided to me. Take courage. He will assist you. His eye beholds you. He can even make use of a feeble instrument like myself to confound a dash. Let us think what can be done." Thus saying, he grasped his beard and chin with his hand, as if to concentrate more completely the powers of his mind. But the more clearly he perceived the pressing nature of the case, the more uncertain and dangerous appeared every mode of meeting it. To endeavor to make Don Abbondio sensible of a failure in duty? This appeared hopeless. Fear was more powerful with him than either shame or duty. To inform the Cardinal Archbishop, and invoke his authority? That would require time,
And, in the meanwhile, what was to be done? To resist Don Roderick? How? Impossible. The affair being one of a private nature, he would not be sustained by the brethren of his order, he would, perhaps, be raising a storm against himself, and, what was worse, by a useless attempt rendered the condition of Lucy more hopeless and deplorable. After many reflections he came to the conclusion to go to Don Roderick himself, and to endeavor by prayers and representations of the punishments of the wicked in another state, to win him from his infamous purpose. At least he might at the interview discover something of his intentions, and determine his measures accordingly. At this moment Renzo, who, as the reader will readily imagine, could not long be absent at so interesting a crisis, appeared at the door of the room. The father raised his head and bowed to him affectionately, and with a look of intense pity. "Have they told you, father?" inquired he, with a troubled voice. "Yes, my son, and on that account I am here." "What do you say of the villain?" "What do I say of __? I say to __, dear Renzo, that you must confide in God, and he will not abandon you." "Blessed words!" exclaimed the youth, "you are not one of those who wrong the poor. But the curate and this doctor. Do not torment yourself uselessly, I am but a poor friar, but I repeat to you that which I have already said to Lucy and her mother, poor as I am, I will never abandon you." "Oh! You are not like the friends of the world rascals when I was in prosperity, abundant in protestations, ready to shed their blood for me, to sustain me against the devil. Had I an enemy, they would soon put it out of his power to molest me. And now, to see them withdraw themselves." He was interrupted in his vituperations by the dark shade which passed over the countenance of his auditor. He perceived the blunder he had made, and attempting to remedy it, became perplexed and confused. "I would say I did not at all intend, that is, I meant to say." "What did you mean to say?" "You have already begun to mar my undertaking. It is well that thou art undeceived in time." "What?" "Thou didst seek friends." "And what friends?" "They could not have aided thee, had they been willing. And thou didst not apply to the only friend who can and will protect thee. Dost thou not know that God is the friend of all who trust in him? Dost thou not know that to spread the talents does little good to the weak?" And even if, at these words he grasped forcibly Renzo's arm, his countenance, without losing his wonted authority, displayed an affecting remorse, his eyes were fixed on the ground, and his voice became slow and sepulchral, "and even if that little should be gained, how terribly awful! Renzo, will you confide in me? That I should say in me? A worm of the dust! Will you not confide in God?"
"Oh! Yes!" replied Renzo, "he only is the Lord."
"Promise me, then, that you will not meet or provoke anyone, that you will suffer yourself to be guided by me."
"I promise," said Renzo. Lucy drew a long breath, as if relieved from a weight, and Agnes was loud in applauses.
"Listen, my children," resumed Father Christopher, "I will go myself today to speak to this man. If God touches his heart through my words, well, if not, __, will provide some other remedy. In the meantime keep yourselves quiet and retired, this evening, or tomorrow at the latest, you shall see me again." Having said this, he departed amidst thanks and blessings. He arrived at the convent in time to perform his daily duty in the choir, dined, and then pursued his way towards the den of the wild beast he had undertaken to tame. The palace of Don Roderick stood by itself, on the summit of one of the promontories that skirt the coast. It was 3 or 4 miles distant from the village. At the foot of the promontory nearest the lake, there was a cluster of decayed cottages inhabited by peasantry belonging to Don Roderick. This was the little capital of his little kingdom. As you cast a glance within their walls, you beheld suspended to them various kinds of arms, with spades, mattocks, and pouches of powder, blended promiscuously. The persons within appeared robust and strong, with a daring and insulting expression of countenance, and wearing a long lock of hair on the head, which was covered with network. The aged, that had lost their teeth, seemed ready to show their gums at the slightest call. Masculine women, with sinewy arms, seemed disposed to use them with as much indifference as their tongues. The very children exhibited the same daring recklessness as the parent stock. Friar Christopher passed through the hamlet, ascending a winding path which conducted him to the little esplanade in the front of the castle. The door was shut, which was a sign that the chief was dining and did not wish to be disturbed. The few windows that looked on the road were small and decayed by time. They were, however, secured by large iron bars, and the lowest of them were more than 10 feet from the ground. A profound silence reigned within, and a traveler might have believed the mansion deserted, but for the appearance of 4 animals, 2 alive and 2 dead, in front of the castle. 2 large vultures, with their wings expanded, were nailed each at the posts of the gate,
and two bravos, extended at full length on the benches on either side, were keeping guard until their master should have finished his repast. The father stopped, as if willing also to wait.
"Father, father, come on," said one, "we do not make the Capuchins wait here, we are the friends of the convent. I have been within its walls when the air on the outside of them was not very wholesome for me. It was well the fathers did not refuse me admittance." So saying, he gave two strokes with the knocker. At the sound, the howls of mastiffs were heard from within, and in a few moments there appeared an aged domestic. On seeing the father, he bowed reverently, quieted the animals with his voice, introduced the guest into a narrow court, and closed the gate. Then escorting him into a saloon, and regarding him with an astonished and respectful look, said, "Is not this the Father Christopher of Pescarenico?"
"The same."
"And here?"
"As you see, good man."
"It must be to do good," continued he, murmuring between his teeth, "good can be done everywhere." He then guided him through two or three dark halls, and led the way to the banqueting room. Here was heard a confused noise of plates, and knives and forks, and discordant voices. Whilst Father Christopher was urging the domestic to suffer him to remain in some other apartment until the dinner should be finished, the door opened. A certain Count Attilia, a cousin of the noble host, of whom we have already spoken, without giving his name, was seated opposite, when he saw the bald head and habit of the father, and perceived his motion to withdraw.
"Ho! Father," cried he, "you shan't escape us, reverend father, forward, forward."
Don Roderick seconded somewhat unwillingly this boisterous command, as he felt some presentiment of the object of his visit.
"Come, father, come in," said he.
Seeing there was no retreating, Father Christopher advanced, saluting the nobleman and his guests. An honest man is generally fearless and undaunted in presence of the wicked. Nevertheless, the father, with the testimony of a good conscience and a firm conviction of the justice of his cause, with a mixture of horror and compassion for Don Roderick, felt a degree of embarrassment in approaching him. He was seated at table, surrounded by guests. On his right was Count Attilia, his colleague in libertinism, who had come from Milan to visit him. To the left was seated, with respectful submissiveness, tempered, however, with conscious security, the underscore podesta underscore of the place, he whose duty it was, according to the proclamation, to cause justice to be done to Renzo Tremolino, and to inflict the allotted penalty on Don Roderick. Nearly opposite to the underscore podesta underscore sat our learned doctor underscore Azeca Garbulii underscore, with his black cap and his red nose, and over against him two obscure guests, of whom our story says nothing beyond a general mention of their toad-eating qualities.
"Give a seat to the father," said Don Roderick.
A servant presented a chair, and the good father apologized for having come at so inopportune an hour. "I would speak with you alone on an affair of importance," added he, in a low tone, to Don Roderick.
"Very well, father, it shall be so," replied he, "but in the meanwhile bring the father something to drink."
Father Christopher would have refused, but Don Roderick, raising his voice above the tumult of the table, cried, "No, by Bacchus, you shall not do me this wrong. A Capuchin shall never leave this house without having tasted my wine, nor an insolent creditor without having tasted the wood of my forests." These words produced a universal laugh, and interrupted for a moment the question which was hotly agitated between the guests. A servant brought the wine, of which Father Christopher partook, feeling the necessity of propitiating the host. "The authority of Tasso is against you, respected senior underscore podesta underscore," resumed aloud the Count Attilia. "This great man was well acquainted with the laws of knighthood, and he makes the messenger of Argantes, before carrying the defiance of the Christian knights, ask permission from the pious Bulian."
"But that," replied vociferously the underscore podesta underscore, "that is poetical license merely. An ambassador is in his nature inviolable, by the law of nations, underscore jurigendium underscore, and moreover, the ambassador, not having spoken in his own name, but merely presented the challenge in writing."
"But when will you comprehend that this ambassador was a daring fool, who did not know the first?"
"With the good leave of our guests," interrupted Don Roderick, who did not wish the argument to proceed farther, "we will refer it to the Father Christopher, and submit to his decision."
"Agreed," said Count Attilia, amused at submitting a question of knighthood to a Capuchin, whilst the underscore podesta underscore muttered between his teeth, "Folly."
"But, from what I have comprehended," said the father, "it is a subject of which I have no knowledge."
"As usual, modest excuses from the father," said Don Roderick, "but we will not accept them. Come, come, we know well that you came not into the world with a cowl on your head, you know something of its ways. Well, how stands the argument?"
"The facts are these,"
said the Count Attilia.
Let me tell, who am neutral, cousin, resumed Don Roderick. This is the story: a Spanish knight sent a challenge to a Milanese knight, the bearer, not finding him at home, presented it to his brother, who, having read it, struck the bearer many blows. The question is.
It was well done, he was perfectly right, cried Count Attilia.
There was no right about it, exclaimed the underscore Podesta underscore. To beat an ambassador, a man whose person is sacred.
Father, do underscore you underscore think this was an action becoming a knight?
Yes, sir, of a knight, cried the Count, I think I know what belongs to a knight.
Oh! If it had been an affair of fists, that would have been quite another thing, but a cudgel soils no one's hands.
I am not speaking of this, Sir Count, I am speaking of the underscore laws underscore of knighthood.
But tell me, I pray you, if the messengers that the ancient Romans sent to bear defiance to other nations, asked permission to deliver the message, find, if you can, a writer who relates that such messenger was ever cudgeled.
What have the ancient Romans to do with us? A people well enough in some things, but in others, far, far behind. But according to the laws of modern knighthood, I maintain that a messenger, who dared place in the hands of a knight a challenge without having previously asked permission, is a rash fool who deserves to be cudgeled.
But answer me this question.
No, no, no.
But hear me. To strike an unarmed person is an act of treachery.
Underscore atiki underscore the messenger underscore de quo underscore was without arms.
Underscore ergo underscore.
Gently, gently, senior underscore Podesta underscore.
How?
Gently.
Gently, I tell you, I concede that under other circumstances this might have been called an act of treachery, but to strike a low fellow. It would have been a fine thing truly, to say to him, as you would to a gentleman, be on your guard. And you, sir doctor, instead of sitting there grinning your approbation of my opinion, why do you not aid me to convince this gentleman?
I, replied the doctor in confusion, I enjoy this learned dispute, and am thankful for the opportunity of listening to a war of wit so agreeable. And moreover, I am not competent to give an opinion, his most illustrious lordship has appointed a judge the father.
True, said Don Roderick. But how can the judge speak when the disputants will not keep silence?
I am dumb, said the Count Attilia. The underscore Podesta underscore made a sign that he would be quiet.
Well, father, at last, said Don Roderick, with comic gravity.
I have already said, that I do not comprehend.
No excuses. We must have your opinion.
If it must be so, replied the father, I should humbly think there was no necessity for challenges, nor bearers, nor blows.
The guests looked in wonder at each other.
Oh! How ridiculous! Said the Count Attilia.
Pardon me, father, but this is exceedingly ridiculous. It is plain you know nothing of the world.
He? Said Don Roderick, he knows as much of it as you do, cousin.
Is it not so, father?
Father Christopher made no reply, but to himself he said, submit thyself to every insult for the sake of those for whom thou art here.
It may be so, said the Count. But the father, how is the father called?
Father Christopher, replied more than one.
But, Father Christopher, your reverend worship, with your maxims you would turn the world upside down without challenges. Without blows.
Farewell, the point of honor.
Impunity to ruffians.
Happily, the thing is impossible.
Stop, doctor, cried Don Roderick, wishing to divert the dispute from the original antagonists. You are a good man for an argument, what have you to say to the father?
Indeed, replied the doctor, brandishing his fork in the air, indeed I cannot understand how the Father Christopher should not remember that his judgment, though of just weight in the pulpit, is worth nothing. I speak with great submission on a question of knighthood. But perhaps he has been merely jesting, to relieve himself from embarrassment.
The father not replying to this, Don Roderick made an effort to change the subject.
Apropos, said he, I understand there is a report at Milan of an accommodation. There was at this time a contest regarding the succession to the dukedom of Mantua, of which, at the death of Vincenzo Gonzaga, who died without male issue, the Duke de Nevers, his nearest relation, had obtained possession.
Louis XIII, or rather the Cardinal de Richelieu, wished to sustain him there.
Philip IV, or rather the Count d'Olivares, commonly called the Count Duke, opposed him. The dukedom was then a fief of the Empire, and the two parties employed intrigue and importunity at the court of the Emperor Ferdinand II. The object of one was to obtain the investiture of the new duke, of the other, the denial of his claim, and also assistance to oblige him to relinquish it.
I rather think,
said the Count Attilia, that the thing will be arranged satisfactorily. I have reasons.
Do not believe it, Count, do not believe it, added the underscore Podesta underscore, I have an opportunity of knowing, because the Spanish keeper of the castle, who is my friend, and who is the son of a dependent of the Count Duke, is informed of everything. I tell you I have discoursed on the subject daily at Milan, and I know from good authority that the Pope, exceedingly interested as he is for peace, has made propositions.
That may be, the thing is in order, His Holiness does his duty, a Pope should always endeavor to make peace between Christian princes, but the Count Duke has his own policy, and,
do you know, Signor underscore Podesta underscore, how much thought the Emperor now gives to it? Do you believe there is no place but Mantua in the world? There are many things to provide for, Signor, mind. Do you know, for instance, how far the Emperor can trust this Prince of Valdistano, or Di Valestai, as they call him, and if his name, in the German language, interrupted the magistrate, is Wallenstein, as I have heard it uttered many times by the Spanish keeper of the castle. But be of good courage.
Do you dare teach me? Replied the Count. Here Don Roderick whispered to him to cease contradiction, as there would be no end to it. He obeyed, and the underscore Podesta underscore, like a vessel unimpeded by shoals, continued with full sails the course of his eloquence. Wallenstein gives me but little anxiety, because the Count Duke has his eye everywhere, and if Wallenstein carries matters with a high hand, he will soon set him right. He has his eye everywhere, I say, and unlimited power, and if it is his policy that the Signor Duke of Nevers should not take root in Mantua, he will never flourish there, be assured. It makes me laugh to see the Signor Cardinal de Richelieu contend with an Olivares. The Count Duke, gentlemen, pursued he, with the wind still in his favor, and much wondering at not meeting with opposition, the Count Duke is an old fox speaking with due respect who would make any one lose his track. When he appears to go to the right, it would be safest to follow him to the left. No one can boast of knowing his designs, they who are to execute them, they who write the dispatches, know nothing of them. I speak from authority, for the keeper of the castle deigns to confide in me. The Count Duke knows well enough how the pot boils in all the courts in Europe, and these politicians have hardly laid a plan, but he begins to frustrate it. That poor man, the Cardinal Richelieu, attempts and dissembles, toils and strives, and what does it all produce? When he has dug the mine, he finds a countermine already prepared by the Count Duke. None can tell when the magistrate would have cast anchor, if Don Roderick had not interrupted him. Signor underscore Podesta underscore, said he, and you, gentlemen, a bumper to the Count Duke, and you shall then judge if the wine is worthy of the personage. The underscore Podesta underscore bowed low in gratitude for an honor he considered as paid to himself in part for his eloquent harangue. May Don Gasparo Guzman, Count de Olivares, Duke of St. Lucar, live 1,000 years, said he, raising his glass. May he live 1,000 years, exclaimed all the company.
Help the father, said Don Roderick.
Excuse me, replied he, I could not.
How? Said Don Roderick, will you not drink to the Count Duke? Would you have us believe that you hold to the Navarre party?
This was the contemptuous term applied to the French interest at the time of Henry IV. There was no reply to be made to this, and the father was obliged to taste the wine. All the guests were loud in its praise, except the doctor, who had kept silence.
Hey. Doctor, asked Don Roderick, what think underscore you underscore of it?
I think, replied the doctor, withdrawing his ruddy and shining nose from the glass, that this is the Olivares of wines, there is not a liquor resembling it in all the 22 kingdoms of the King our Master, whom God protect. I maintain that the dinners of the most illustrious Signor Don Roderick exceed the suppers of Heliogabalus, and that scarcity is banished forever from this palace, where reigns a perpetual and splendid abundance.
Well said.
Bravo.
Bravo.
Exclaimed with one voice the guests, but the word underscore scarcity underscore, which the doctor had accidentally uttered, suggested a new and painful subject. All spoke at once, there is no famine, said one, it is the speculators who.
And the bakers. Who conceal the grain.
Hang them.
That is right, hang them, without mercy.
Upon fair trial, cried the magistrate.
What trial?
Cried Attilia, more loudly, summary justice, I say. Take a few of them who are known to be the richest and most avaricious, and hang them.
Yes, hang them.
Hang them.
And there will be grain scattered in abundance.
Thus the party continued absorbing the wine, whose praises, mixed with sentences of economical jurisprudence, formed the burthen of the conversation,
so that the loudest and most frequent words were, underscore nectar, and hang em underscore.
Don Roderick had, from time to time, during this confusion, looked at the father, perceiving him calmly, but firmly, awaiting his leisure for the interview which had been promised him, he relinquished the hope of wearying him by its postponement. To send away a Capuchin, without giving him an audience, was not according to his policy, and since it could not be avoided, he resolved to meet it at once. He rose from the table, excused himself to his guests, and saying proudly, "At your service, Father," led the way to another room.
Chapter 6.
"In what can I serve you?" said Don Roderick, as soon as they entered into the room. Such were his words, but his manner said plainly, "Remember before whom thou standest, weigh well thy words, and be expeditious." There were no means more certain to impart courage to Father Christopher than arrogance or pride. He had stood for a moment in some embarrassment, passing through his fingers the beads of the rosary that hung suspended from his girdle, but he soon resumed new courage, and revived, at the haughty air of Don Roderick. He had, however, sufficient command over himself to reply with caution and humility. "I come to supplicate you to perform an act of justice. Some wicked persons have, in the name of your lordship, frightened a poor curate, and have endeavored to prevent his fulfilling his duty towards an innocent and unoffending couple. You can by a word confound their machinations, and impart consolation to the afflicted. You can in having it in your power conscience, honor. Speak to me of conscience, when I ask your advice on the subject, and as to my honor, know that I only am the guardian of it, and that whoever dares to meddle with it is a rash man." Friar Christopher, warned by these words that the intention of Don Roderick was to turn the conversation into a dispute, so as to win him from his original purpose, determined to bear whatever insult might be offered him, and meekly replied, "It was certainly not my intention to say anything to displease you. Correct me, reprove me, but deign to listen to me. By the love of heaven, by that God before whom we must all appear, I charge thee, do not obstinately refuse to do justice to the innocent and oppressed. Think that God watches over them, that their imprecations are heard above, and—"
"Stop," interrupted Don Roderick, rudely. "The respect I bear to your habit is great, but if anything could make me forget it, it would be to see it worn by one coming as a spy into my house." These words spread an indignant glow over the face of the father, but swallowing them as a bitter medicine, he resumed, "You do not believe that I am such. You feel in your heart that I am here on no vile or contemptible errand. Listen to me, Signor Don Roderick, and heaven grant that the day may never arrive, when you shall repent of not having listened to me. Listen to me, and perform this deed of justice and benevolence. Men will esteem you. God will esteem you. You have much in your power, but—"
"Do you know," again interrupted Don Roderick with warmth, but with something like remorse, "that when the whim takes me to hear a sermon, I can go to church. But, perhaps," continued he, with a forced smile of mockery, "you are putting regal dignity on me, and giving me a preacher in my own palace. And to God princes are responsible for the reception of his messages. To God you are responsible. He now sends into your palace a message by one of his ministers, the most unworthy.
In short, Father," said Don Roderick, preparing to go, "I do not comprehend you. I suppose you have some affair of your own on hand. Make a confidant of whom you please, but use not the freedom of troubling a gentleman any farther."
"Don Roderick, do not say underscore no underscore to me. Do not keep in anguish the heart of an innocent child. A word from you would be sufficient."
"Well," said Don Roderick, "since you think I have so much in my power, and since you are so much interested."
"Yes," said Father Christopher, anxiously regarding him.
"Well, advise her to come, and place herself under my protection. She will want for nothing, and no one shall disturb her, as I am a gentleman." At such a proposal, the indignation of the friar, which had hitherto been restrained with difficulty, loudly burst forth. All his prudence and patience forsook him. "Your protection!" exclaimed he, stepping back, and stretching forth both his hands towards Don Roderick, while he sternly fixed his eyes upon him. "Your protection! You have filled the measure of your guilt by this wicked proposal, and I fear you no longer.
Dare you speak thus to me?"
"I dare, I fear you no longer. God has abandoned you, and you are no longer an object of fear. Your protection! This innocent child is under the protection of God. You have, by your infamous offer, increased my assurance of her safety. Lucy, I say, see with what boldness I pronounce her name before you, Lucy."
"How?"
"In this house."
"I compassionate this house, the wrath of God is upon it. You have acted in open defiance of the great God of heaven and earth, you have set at naught his counsel, you have oppressed the innocent,
You have trampled on the rights of those whom you should have been the first to protect and defend. The wrath of God is upon you. A day will come.
Villain! Said Don Roderick, who at first was confounded between rage and astonishment, but when he heard the father thundering forth this prediction, a mysterious and unaccountable dread took possession of his soul. Hastily seizing his outstretched arm, and raising his voice in order to drown the maledictions of the monk, he cried aloud, "Depart from me, rash villain, cowled spy!" These words instantly cooled the glowing enthusiasm of Father Christopher. The ideas of insult and injury in his mind had long been habitually associated with those of suffering and silence. His usual habits resumed their sway, and he became calm. He awaited what farther might be said, as, after the strength of the whirlwind has passed, an aged tree naturally recomposes its branches, and receives the hail as heaven sends it.
Villain! Scoundrel! Talk to your equals, said Don Roderick, but thank the habit you bear for saving you from the chastisement which is your due. Be gone this instant, and with unscathed limbs, or we shall see. So saying, he pointed imperiously to an opposite door. The friar bowed his head, and departed, leaving Don Roderick to measure with hasty and agitated steps the field of battle. When he had closed the door behind him, the father perceived a man stealing softly away through another, and he recognized him as the aged domestic who had been his guide to the presence of Don Roderick. Before the birth of that nobleman, he had been in the service of his father, who was a man of a very different character. At his death, the new master expelled all the domestics, with the exception of this one, whom he retained on account of two valuable qualifications: a high conception of the dignity of the house, and a minute knowledge of the ceremonial required to support that dignity. The poor old man had never dared even to hint disapprobation of the daily proceedings at the castle before the senior, but he would sometimes venture to allow an exclamation of grief and disapproval to escape him before his fellow servants, who were infinitely diverted by his simple honesty, and his warm love of the good old times. His censures did not reach his master's ears unaccompanied by a relation of the raillery bestowed upon them, so that he became an object of general ridicule. On the days of formal entertainment, therefore, the old man was a person of great importance. Father Christopher bowed to him as he passed by him, and pursued his way, but the old man approached him with a mysterious air, and made a sign that he should follow him into a dark passage, where, speaking in an undertone, he said, "Father, I have heard all, and I want to speak to you."
"Speak at once, then, good man."
"Here. Oh no. Woe be to us if the master suspect it. But I shall be able to discover much, and I will endeavor to come tomorrow to the convent."
"Is there any base plot?"
"There is something hatching, certainly, I have long suspected it, but now I shall be on the lookout, and I will come at the truth. These are strange doings. I live in a house where, but I wish to save my soul."
"God bless you," said the friar, placing his hands on his head, as he bent reverently towards him, "God reward you. Do not forget then to come tomorrow."
"I will not," replied the domestic, "but go, now, for the love of heaven, and do not betray me." So saying, he looked cautiously on all sides, and led the way through the passage into a large hall, which fronted the courtyard, and pointing to the door, silently bade him farewell. When once in the street, and freed from this den of depravity, the father breathed more freely. He hastened down the hill, pale in countenance, and agitated and distressed by the scene he had witnessed, and in which he had taken so leading a part. But the unlooked-for proffer of the servant came like a cordial. It seemed as if heaven had sent a visible sign of its protection, a clue to guide him in his intricate undertaking and in the very house where it was least likely to be found. Occupied with these thoughts, he raised his eyes towards the west, and beheld the sun declining behind the mountain, and felt that he had but a few minutes in which to reach the monastery, without violating the absolute law of the Capuchins, that none of the brotherhood should remain beyond the walls after sunset. Meanwhile, in the cottage of Lucy there had been plans agitated of which it is necessary to inform the reader. After the departure of the father, they had continued some time in silence. Lucy, with a heavy heart, prepared the dinner. Renzo, wavering and anxious, knew not how to depart. Agnes was apparently absorbed with her reel, but she was really maturing a thought, which she in a few moments thus declared,
"Listen, my children. If you will have the necessary courage and dexterity, if you will confide in your mother, I pledge myself to free you from perplexity, sooner than Father Christopher could do, although he is the best man in the world." Lucy looked at her mother with an expression of astonishment rather than confidence, in a promise so magnificent.
"Courage! Dexterity!" cried Renzo. Say, what can I do?"
"Is it not true," said Agnes, "that if you were married,
your chief difficulty would be removed, and that for the rest we would easily find a remedy.
Undoubtedly, said Renzo, if we were married the world is before us, and at a short distance from this, in Bergamo, a silk weaver is received with open arms. You know how often my cousin Bartolo has solicited me to go there, and enter into business with him, how many times he has told me that I should make a fortune, as he has done, and if I never listened to his request, it was because my heart was here. Once married, we would all go together, and live happily far from the clutches of this villain, far from the temptation to do a rash deed. Is it not so, Lucy?
Yes, said Lucy, but how?
As I said, resumed Agnes, courage and dexterity, and the thing is easy.
Easy! Exclaimed they, in wonder.
Easy, replied Agnes, if you are prudent. Hear me patiently, and I will endeavor to